All lines are now bridged.
Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our second meeting of the year here. We've had quite a bit of news and activity from the ONC side, including our new national coordinator. So looking forward to hearing from him a little later. As a reminder, especially to our new members, please remember to use the raise hand function in Adobe if you'd like to make a comment or a question. It's in the kind of upper left slash middle of your screen. So not as long as our meeting last month, but we've got some important content to cover. So with that, I am going to get started with roll call. Erin Mary.
Good morning.
Denise Webb.
Good morning.
Denise on. Michael Adcock indicated he would be absent today. Lisa Fry.
Good morning.
Cynthia Fisher.
Good morning.
Brad Gishider. Oops, sorry about that. Valerie Gray.
Here. Good morning.
Stephen Hester.
Good morning.
Jim Georges. Not yet. Okay. John Kansky.
Yeah, I'm. Give me 5 minutes. I need to give my roll call and I'll come.
Okay. I don't think that was John. Was that either Jim Georges or John Kansky? Okay, we'll circle back. Ken Kalmoda.
Good morning.
Good morning. Stephen Lane.
Good morning.
Good morning. Les Leonard.
I'm here.
Good morning. Arian Malik.
Wait, that's the other way. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Clem McDonald. Not yet. Brett Oliver.
Good morning.
Morning. Terry O'Malley. Not yet. Okay. James Pintella.
Good morning.
Good morning. Carolyn Peterson.
Good morning, everyone.
Raj Ratwani.
Good morning.
Good morning. Abby Fear.
Here. Good morning.
Good morning. Alexis Snyder. Not yet. Sasha Terma.
Good morning.
Good morning. Andy Truscott.
Good morning.
Good morning. Cheryl Turney.
Good morning.
Robert Watt.
Present. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. Michelle Schreiber.
Morning. Present.
James Elzey.
Good morning.
Ram Charam.
Good morning.
Good morning. Adi Gundalapi? Adi, not yet. Jonathan Nebaker?
Hey, good morning.
Morning. And Amy Abernathy? Okay, not yet. And then from our ONC leadership side, of course, we have our national coordinator, Mickey Tricuffi, Deputy National Coordinator, Steve Posnack, Executive Director of Policy, Elise Sini-Anthony, and Executive Director of Technology, Avinash Shambhag. And before we turn it over to our national coordinator, I'll turn it over to our co-chairs to start with a few opening remarks, and then we'll jump into the meeting. Denise and Erin.
All right. Fantastic. Well, welcome, everybody, to the February edition of the HITACH. I guess this is our Valentine's edition. We would do something around health policy Valentine's, but we'll spare all of you that joy. So welcome, and I look forward to today's meeting. Denise? Denise, you there?
Oh, I apologize. I must have hit my mute button. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to our second meeting of the year. And we have an ambitious agenda this morning, and we're especially looking forward to welcoming our new national coordinator, Mickey Tripathi, after we approve our minutes. And then we're going to go into a vote. We're ready to vote on our annual report, our FY20 annual report. Following that, we're going to have our co-chairs, Stephen Lane and Terry O'Malley, give an update on our USCDI version 2 task force work. We've had two meetings so far. Then we're going to get a presentation from ONC on Project USA. Following that, Larry Jessup from ONC is going to introduce two of our cooperative agreement recipients of the STAR HIE program. That's two of five, so that'll be the Texas Health Services Authority and the HealthShare Exchange, Pennsylvania. And then our final presentation will be on the interoperability standards priorities. And we'll go to public comment. We'll want to stay on track, so we do that on time, and then we'll conclude with any final remarks and adjourn. Before we have Nikki welcome himself and make some remarks, I'm going to turn it back over to Aaron for any other remarks he has and to approve the meeting minutes.
Absolutely. So let me first say welcome to all of you again for joining, and I am really honored and pleased on behalf of the HITAC to introduce you all to our newest national coordinator, Mickey Tripathi. So Mickey, congratulations on your appointment. Welcome to the HITAC. I know that you are an alum from the Standards Committee days and the wonderful work you did there and your laser focus on outcomes, which will be very welcome to our group here. The HITAC is a group of just brilliant clinicians, technologists, healthcare professionals, patient advocates, and you coming and joining us is a phenomenal addition, and we really welcome that. And we also look forward to collaborating with you on some of the newest classic rock mixtapes. I'm certain that we'll all collaborate and come up with. So welcome, Mickey, and I'll turn over the floor to you.
Great.
Oh,
thanks.
Before
so
we
much,
do that, Aaron, can we approve the minutes?
Okay.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. Can we get a motion for approval for the minutes?
Approve.
Approve.
And a second. All right. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Anyone with a nay, say nay. All right, minutes are approved. It wouldn't be Health IT if we didn't have some little kerfuffle. So, Mickey, over to you, sir.
Oh, you're so excited.
let the minutes record that the minutes were approved. Thank you so much, Aaron, Denise, and welcome. This is my first HITAC meeting as the national coordinator, and I really want to welcome and thank everyone for joining. And it's just fantastic to see so many familiar faces and friends over the years, and also some new faces who I know just by name and reputation, but I look forward to getting to know all of you and working with you. I know a number of you, I've worked with a number of you over the years, but I know a number of you may not have a good sense of my background and what brought me here, so I just thought I'd give a little bit of background. And that begins with something that many of you may not know, is that I have past federal service. I worked as a federal employee a while ago for like 6 or 7 years in the Pentagon, in the Secretary of Defense's office and on the Air Staff, in the Air Force Chief of Staff's office, where I was a Presidential Management Fellow. And I worked in the federal government for 6 years, roughly, before leaving, going back to academia and onto other things. But it's really exciting to be back working directly on the people's work. I really couldn't be more excited about doing that, particularly at this time in the industry with all of the great opportunities that we have ahead of us, as well as the challenges. I've worked in health IT. My beginnings were working in Indianapolis, where I was able to work with the Reagan Street Institute and some of those legendary figures there, like Clem McDonald, who I know is here on the phone. Imagine learning health IT from Clem McDonald directly. That was one of the greatest opportunities ever. But helping there with launching the Indian Health Information Exchange through leading the Massachusetts Health Collaborative for a number of years, which was a collaboration of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts, the Massachusetts Medical Society, and the American College of Physicians, to collaborative industry initiatives over many years, such as the Argonaut Project, HL7, the Sequoia Project. I feel like I've spent in my career in Health IT working on collaboration and trying to bring everyone together on the things that we can agree on and we can move forward on. So I couldn't be more excited about that capital C part of the national coordinator's role and what I hope we can, you know, sort of help with here. What's interesting is, you know, in just my short time, I'll just remind everyone I'm on day 15, working day 15, I shouldn't say working day, business day 15 of my current job. But as closely as I've worked with ONC over the years, you know, you think that you know everything, and then you just cross that little border and you're on the other side of it, and you look around, and it's like, oh, huh, there's a lot here that I'm familiar with and a lot that I'm not familiar with. So I, you know, really am excited about the learning opportunities here to be able to, you know, be able to exercise everything that we can do from the national coordinator side. And, you know, very grateful to the fantastic team that ONC has, many of whom I knew from before. But we've really got, you know, just an amazing team here, and I'm really grateful that this team is, you know, is here and can just, you know, keep everything moving very rapidly. It's, you know, particularly grateful because we're all working remotely right now. So for any of you who may wonder where, you know, where Command Central is right now for ONC, we're here in Newton, Massachusetts in my study, and we're going to be fully remote as an administration policy. We're going to be fully remote for a while. You know, with an emphasis on maximizing workplace safety. So, you know, all of the ONC staff is working remotely, including me, and we'll continue to do that until there's a, sort of a change at the administration level in terms of, you know, how we're going to, you know, sort of manage the slow coming back based on the data and based on, you know, based on workplace safety considerations. I will say, you know, I just so deeply respect the work of FACA, as Aaron pointed out, having lived it on the other side for many years with the HIT Policy Committee and the HIT Standards Committee. And I, you know, appreciate both, you know, the sort of the energy, I think, and the expertise and experience that the FACAs can bring to the table, and also appreciate how much work it is, because for all of you, it's volunteer work. And I appreciate so much, you know, and have lived it, how much work that is. And, you know, we try not to abuse the privilege with you, but, you know, greatly respect, you know, all the contributions that you've made and that you'll continue to make looking forward. We do have an incredibly busy year ahead of us. I think Denise laid out the agenda that we have today. So a few things that I just want to raise for your awareness, and then I'll turn it back to Aaron and Denise for any final comments and to begin the agenda, is, you know, one, as I, you know, pointed out, I'm on business day 15. So while I was able to hit the ground running, I hope you appreciate that I'm on business day 15. So just want to, you know, sort of give you a little bit of awareness here, but, you know, with more to come as we start to shape the program and move forward with it. But, you know, first off, you know, COVID is the top priority of the administration, ONC included, right? And that's full stop, you know, period, full stop. And there are a number of executive orders that I think you all have seen and are familiar with. And there is an HHS, and there's a government-wide effort, but an HHS-wide effort now to sort of build the structure for executing those executive orders. And so we're working with all of the other operating and staff divisions to break all of those down into work streams and then to implement those. So we'll certainly have more to share on that once the dust settles on that and that's, you know, fully in place, but that's active work going on and is sort of, you know, rapidly getting launched here. We also, and you'll start to see that we're starting to build, you know, sort of the educational program and the outreach program to support the Cures Act final rule. You know, we've got the April 5th applicability date coming up. You should have, hopefully, were able to participate in the Frequently Asked Questions webinar that we had last week. The recording is available. That was available on February 4th. And you'll start to see more and more from ONC in terms of education and outreach. And we, you know, really look forward to working with all of you on that. We also, you know, as we discussed, I think as was discussed at the last HITECH meeting, you know, we anticipate the need to engage a number of, you know, new task forces this year. So, but again, we appreciate, you know, all of your interest in those. And, you know, we're sort of now figuring out which ones need to get launched in what priority order and who should go where. But we really appreciate that. And that's going to be, you know, very active part of what we do going forward. The newly reconstituted USCDI version 2 task force, I think, has already met twice. And I think we're going to hear from them today. And that's, you know, sort of exciting for us because that, you know, the USCDI process is an incredibly important part of, you know, the many things that that we do here at ONC. And then finally, I would be greatly remiss if I didn't just remind everyone, you've probably gotten tweets and emails about this, but to save the date for the ONC annual meeting, which is coming up on March 29th and 30th, the registration information should be coming shortly, but I absolutely wanted to make sure that all of you are aware of that, and really look forward to your participation there. So, you know, I really, again, just want to especially thank our new co-chairs, Aaron and Denise. I really look forward to working with you, and the entire ONC team does. I also want to offer thanks to Robert and Carolyn, and I know I can with confidence extend thanks from my predecessor, Don Rucker, as well, for your leadership over the past 3 years. And again, I know it's a lot of work and a lot of responsibility, and we really appreciate everything you've done, and look forward to working with Aaron and Denise going forward. So again, I just want to thank everyone. I'm really delighted to be here. I just couldn't be more excited. Look forward to working with each of you together and individually, and please reach out anytime. But let me turn it over back to Denise and Aaron now for any additional remarks before we get started.
Thank you, Mickey. Appreciate that. Appreciate the comments, and we look forward to it as well. All right. So with that, I think, Denise, unless there's anything you would like to add, we can go on to the next item.
I would just like to thank Mickey for your introduction and your remarks. And again, welcome and congratulations. And Aaron, I apologize. And to the rest of the committee, I am having camera problems, so I'll see if I can remedy that. But we are going to take a vote today on the annual report. The work group has done a fantastic job. ONC has provided tremendous support for us getting to this place today. And thank you to our co-chairs, Aaron and Carolyn. So I think we can proceed with our discussion for a vote on our annual report work group. And I think you have a little presentation. Is that correct, Aaron?
Yes, ma'am, we do.
Before we take our vote? Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
I'm going to turn it over to Aaron and Carolyn.
Sure. Carolyn, you want to kick us off?
Sure. Good morning, everyone. Great to see you again. And as Aaron said, happy Valentine's Day. If we could have the next slide, please. So today we are here to look at the revised draft of the annual report, which we revised based on your comments from the January meeting, and hopefully to take a vote on that. Could we have the next slide, please? And the next slide. So if you're familiar with our schedule, today we're just about at the point of voting and moving the report forward to the national coordinator. Next slide, please. And the next slide. So today really is just some time for us to discuss answer any questions that you have any further discussion about what's in the report. And Aaron and I are happy to answer your questions.
Yeah, maybe we could ask the ONC team to pull up the Excel team to pull up, please, the final report on here. And while that's being done, I want to take a moment and thank Michelle, Elise, the entire ONC, Lauren, the entire ONC team. As Carolyn and I have been saying over the past several years, this work product, even though it has all the high-tech feedback and the feedback to the public and the feedback that goes into it, really is just a heroic work and effort work product by the ONC team. And so we really thank them tremendously from the bottom of our heart for their just amazing, amazing ability. So with that, we would like to really talk about this, because this is the meeting where we need to approve this and then move it forward or have further discussion. So let's just open it up to general questions. Any questions from any high-tech member? I'll talk at once. Okay. I see Stephen Lane.
Yeah, really more a comment, Aaron, than a question. Just this is such a labor of love that you all have put together and everyone who provided input and comments. along the way. I mean, it's really a marvelous document, and I think a great thing to hand over to a new administration, a new leadership at the ONC to really fully describe the depth and the breadth of consideration that's been taken, and really the enthusiasm that the HITAC has for contributing to the work of the ONC and helping to move that forward. So I just really want to give a big thank you to the team who assembled this.
Thanks, Stephen.
Thank you, Stephen.
Appreciate it.
So I will say for this report, as we have always done in every year, we continue to get better and we continue to learn. And so feedback, comments, all that have been captured, have been logged, even comments that maybe are going to go to a future edition. As you can see over the years, we always reference the comments from the HITAC, and it feeds year over year. Sometimes we're waiting for a rule to be finalized or whatever else. We can't put it in the report, but it's not like it's forgotten. So please, if there are other things, even as we prepare to start planning the next year's report, please feed them to us. Let us know your thoughts. Let us know what's going on there. The other welcome addition to this year's report is, as I mentioned last meeting, we sort of synthesized in a real-world story each of the sections, each of our charges, and what it would look like once we solve, say, interoperability or privacy and security challenges. So try to look at those stories, and that we're trying to connect the policy levers and the technical comments and interoperability explanations into what does this mean for a clinician? What does this mean for a patient? What does this mean for the general public? Those are important because it begins to anchor our work in all the bits and pieces. This is not easy, but the more we can conversationalize these challenges and look for levers to work through them, the faster we can get to goal as an industry and take care of patients at a much faster rate and a better rate. So any more comments from the HITAC?
If no further comments, we might be ready for a vote, Aaron and Carolyn?
I believe so. Carolyn, what do you think?
Absolutely, if we're for no further discussion.
All right.
Okay, well, if there's no further discussion, if I could have someone make a motion for approval of the HITAC annual report for fiscal year 2020.
Move approval.
Second.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those who are not in favor, say nay. Any abstentions? Well, it looks like we have approval for our annual report for fiscal year 20. Congratulations for all the hard work.
All right.
Thank you.
Well done, HITAC. Well done. Okay.
All right. Up next, we have an update from our USCDI Task Force co-chairs. I'll turn it over to Stephen and Terry.
Thank you so much. Terry, did you join us? I didn't hear him in the initial roll call. Well, let me forge ahead and let me thank everyone for relaunching the USCDI Task Force and giving us an opportunity to meet again. We do have pulled together a marvelous group of people this time. On the next slide, you have the roster of folks who are involved in our task force, a number of you from the HITAC, as well as additional folks who have been involved in other efforts within and beyond ONC. So it's really quite an engaged group. As you've heard, we do have had two meetings thus far and have really started to dig in already to the charges of the task force. This is the third iteration of the USCDI Task Force this year. We've had two prior groups that have met and worked through a number of issues, but this time the group was pulled together specifically to address the draft version 2 that was published earlier by ONC to collect comments and observations, suggestions, and bring them forward to the HITAC by mid-April. In the same time frame that the public comment is being collected, And then there will be a set of recommendations brought here for extension on to the national coordinator. I apologize if you're hearing my dogs barking in the background. My wife's trying to get them breakfast. On the next slide, you'll see the task force charges. Specifically to review and make recommendations on the draft version 2 of USCDI, as I mentioned. But then we've broken that down into a number of sub-charges. The first focus between now and April is to evaluate that version 2 draft and provide recommendations around changes that have been made from or in the USCDI version 1 categories that have already been out there in the public space for a long time. We've been focusing on this initially. There are also a number of applicable terminology standards that apply to those version one data classes and elements. So those have been proposed to advance as those versions have advanced. We're then starting to dive into the new classes and elements that were proposed to be in draft version 2 by the ONC, and then also looking at all of the data elements that were leveled at level 2 that were felt to be technically ready and feasible to bring into the USCDI, but only a subset of those were actually suggested in the draft version 2 for advancement. After April, once we've worked our way through that, we're going to be refocused on the USCDI expansion process to provide recommendations back here to HITECH about the ONDEC system that was built to collect suggestions, the evaluation criteria and process used to assign those suggested data elements and classes to levels, and then the prioritization process, which I think is really key. I think many stakeholders were struck by the modest size of the changes in draft version 2, and that's raised a lot of questions about how did ONC decide to approach this and how to prioritize items that are technically ready to be really brought forward into the USCDI. So the group has already said that they're interested in developing a recommended set of guiding principles that could be used to inform that prioritization process. I think people are really engaged in that. So on the next slide, we do mention here what is out of scope for the task force, and I think some task force members were disappointed by this, but we have not been asked to look at suggested data elements and classes that were leveled as level 1 and level 2. We've come to learn that a lot of work has been done by the ONC to evaluate the many, many submitted data classes and elements, to look at their technical readiness, the degree to which they have been utilized in connectathons, in the production system, et cetera. So there are many, many elements that were set at the comment or the level 1 level within ONDEC, and the task force has been invited to submit individual comments through the ONDEC system regarding those, but we're not going to be looking at those at the task force level. On the next slide is a graphic that displays all of the items currently in USCDI draft version 2. Those with the stars or the little arrows next to them are those that have changed since version 1. So the starred items are either new or moved. I guess all the starred items are new, which is to say we've created, or the ONC has suggested, two new data classes around diagnostic imaging and encounter information. They moved over a couple of data elements from other classes to be consistent there. And then there's been a small number of new data elements that have been proposed, which we'll come back to. On the next slide, I mentioned the applicable terminology standards that have advanced between the time of the publication of version 1 and today. So our task force has already gone through these and felt that these were appropriate to update. Some of these may update even further before the April timeframe. So SNOMED, for example, I think we heard might have another version, but we'll come back to the high tech with recommendations about these. On the next slide, you will see the recategorization or reclassification of a few data elements into these new data classes specified for diagnostic imaging and laboratory. On the next slide, you see the truly new data elements that have been proposed for inclusion in USCDI version 2. As you can see, really quite a modest list. The approach here really came from the recommendations from prior USCDI task forces and the ONC to really keep the iterative changes quite modest so that the industry could adapt to them. I think our task force is going to spend a lot of time discussing whether these were the appropriate items to add, whether there are others that should be added to this list or swapped out. And again, those recommendations will come back here for review prior to advancing them to ONC. On the next slide is a good graphic representation of the timeline that we are in the midst of. This describes the annual review process or cycle that we're going through. Again, here we are kind of just in this first red and blue box where the HITACH through our USCDI task force is collecting comments and preparing a report as well as collecting public comments. It ends up that all of the comments that come forward to the HITACH will need to be made part of the public record. So as we're reaching out to various folks across the community, we're inviting them to submit their comments through the website. So as those come in, all of us have the chance to review those in their native form, as well as the discussions that we're having in our task force. Once we finish our work in April, ONC will review all of our and the public comments and come out with a final USCDI version 2 in the middle of the year, after which that will be considered for addition to the standards version advancement process. And I'm sure we'll get more detail on that again when that time comes. And then as you see, it starts the next cycle. So I think a lot of the work that our task force is going to be doing will really be to inform the next cycle, this being the first sort of recycling of the USCDI after its initial publication. Again, in the midst of the pandemic and with everything else going on, this is probably going to be a relatively modest change, but I think there's a lot of energy to see this move forward in the future to support nationwide interoperability, and hopefully our work will set us up for the next cycle as well. On the next slide, you just see what we've laid out. We have a pretty ambitious schedule of weekly meetings. And as Mickey said, being on a FACA or a FACA task force is a lot of work, but I think our team is up for it. Most of the folks on the team are really quite seasoned at this, and they've jumped in with both feet. So I'll stop there and ask Al Taylor from the ONC staff, who's really providing primary support and is really the engine behind USCDI, to add anything that I might have left out.
No, Stephen, thank you. I think you covered everything very well. Should there be any questions, taking those questions through the task force or through the comment system, as Stephen mentioned, or directly through ONC is what we'd like to see.
Great. Well, if there are no questions, we'll hand it back to you, Denise and Aaron.
Actually, Stephen, this is Denise. I'm on the task force, and I just have a question or comment. I was wondering, did you want to highlight any of the more meaty topics that we've already gotten into and mention those to the committee, just for any reflection from the entire committee? Or do you think that's premature?
Well, I mean, we certainly can. I don't know how much time we had. It looks like we are sort of ahead of schedule as it is. But I think, again, as I intimated, the main issue that's come up, and I'm sorry I wasn't sharing my camera earlier, I thought I was, The main issue that's come up has really been the modesty of the additions, you know, really rather small additions. So there have clearly been key groups who've come forward or constituencies that have said, gee, you know, there's all these other things that are so important that we really should be considering adding. And Mickey, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I mean, in your new role, you know, I think you're going to be in a position to help inform, you know, ONC's approach to this. You know, are we going to keep this really a small lift for the purported benefit that brings to providers and vendors, or are we going to be more ambitious? There's clearly been input that the pandemic response itself would be highly benefited by making USCDI more robust, more quickly, that driving the specific exchange of identified priority data elements could really help us in the response. So I think there was a large and a thoughtful submission from the public health community about what was needed to support that. And I was involved in putting that together. Similarly, so much work has been going on in the area of social determinants of health, which of course also overlap with pandemic response, given the issues of equity and the impact that race and ethnicity and socioeconomic status has had on the effects of the virus in our communities. And you can go on and on, the research community, the transplant community. There are a number of communities that really were looking forward to USCDI advancement as an opportunity to move data to support their use cases and their constituencies. So I think we need to really dig deep and make a decision as to whether we're USCDI will be an opportunity to really advance things more quickly, or whether it's going to be a little bit of a follower and following and seeing where the industry is going and then bringing that into standards. Just a reminder that once the USCDI is versioned each year, there's then the decision as to whether to make it a part of the standards version advancement process. That process is a little more complex than some of us, I think, originally appreciated. It's kind of a one-way door where a vendor says, okay, I'm going to embrace USCDI version X. And when they do, that means they have to do all of it at once. But vendors can advance individual standards, add individual data elements. So the USCDI still creates a roadmap whether or not one actually takes advantage of the standards version advancement process. And then, of course, in the future, there needs to be rulemaking by ONC, by CMS, by others that will point to the advancing standard and essentially require it. So what we're doing is we're building up the floor upon which interoperability will occur. I think there are also questions really about what is the scope of applicability for USCDI. That is to say, is this really just focused on EHR type data, or is this going to be used to address the needs of other communities, the long-term post-acute care, you name it. There are many, many communities where they're not dealing with EHR certified applications, so there is a complex relationship between USCDI, things like information blocking, CMS rules, health IT certification. So the teams at ONC and CMS who are pointing to this standard are all also trying to work in concert so that it moves forward apace. So I think, Denise, that's what you were getting at. Was there something else that you wanted to bring forward?
Yeah. Oh. No, absolutely. Thank you for those comments. And I would have to echo that complexity has been challenging for a number of healthcare CIOs to really understand, you know, what the intent is of the USCDI. Oftentimes I've heard, well, you know, if all of this is added to our EHR, then we're required to collect this information. And I think there's a lot of confusion about fact that the USCDI is trying to raise the bar on interoperability and exchange of those data elements, But of course, once those elements are in the USCDI, then they then become the domain of other programs, such as CMS programs, to then require certain things from healthcare providers. So I think the complexity that you described has created some confusion amongst a number of healthcare organizations about the goals and objectives and exactly the intent of the USCDI.
Go ahead. You're exactly right. I was going to say you're exactly right, Denise. And I also think that, you know, speaking from an academic healthcare perspective, especially as we do contact tracing and vaccination as a major vaccine hub for the city of Austin, there are data classes and data elements that we really need to do a better job of exchanging. That still, you hear the traditional, just fax it over to me. And it just, I just shake my head like, you got to be kidding me. We're still living with fax machines. So there's, this has, USCDI has to be a mechanism to push forward. And the more clarity we can bring, which I appreciate, Stephen, your leadership in this and helping to ground us, just like you did with all your phenomenal work over the summer with the CDC, is just critical, right? And I think, Mickey, exactly to what Stephen was saying, this is an area of great opportunity and great interest, both on the vendor and the provider community. Stephen, you were saying something?
Right. I think other communities as well. I mean, CMS has come forward and said, you know, gee, we'd really like to see additional elements in USCDI version 2 to support our work as well. So I think thinking about this as the complex kind of linchpin of interoperability that it can be, and how to right size it so that it balances the needs of all of these communities, constituencies, use cases is going to be very important. I think that our task force's work will contribute to that, but it's really not the key charge of the task force. We're more down in the weeds looking at the individual data elements and data classes, and I think we're going to do that well. But I think as we come back with reports to the HITACH, that's a good opportunity to raise these issues and see how ONC intends to respond to them.
Excellent, excellent. All right, now I see some questions and some engagement from the team here. So first up is Arian Malik.
This is a surprise, so apologies for not putting video on. It is still early in California, and you probably don't want to see my background right now. So this conversation that we just got into, I think, is a really grounding conversation. And I might go so far as to say that if something is in USCDI, the expectation, yes, should be that it is something that is routinely collected, routinely and routinely used in practice. The classic example that I pointed out is the mapping that should have been and still could be done between clinical quality measures and EHR data. I think this is an area that
that Mickey knows
quite well.
Quite well.
Let me turn my. I'm getting an echo here, so apologies. If I stumble through my words. So yes, my expectation should be that if we add an element into the OCDI, we should have a path collected for the purpose for which it is used for interoperability, that we think about the downstream consequences of adding things into USCDI. So what is that data going to be used for? And we don't make the mistake of adding something that, you know, aspirationally we would like to do without thinking through the clinical workflow implications and the downstream interoperability workflow implications of adding data into USCDI. You know, one of the ways that I frame this is that if a medical society wants to put things into a clinical quality measure, they should also do the work of making sure that their clinicians routinely collect and capture that item if it's relevant for quality measures. I pick on quality measures because it's an egregious example here, but you know, as Aaron just noted, we did work back in April on where demographic data was going into for COVID testing, and you know, one of the things that became pretty obvious there is that the expectations of bidirectional ordering and the expectations of data use for bidirectional ordering hadn't been mapped across the ecosystem. So lab partners, even though data were available, weren't routinely being passed that data in order for it to be passed downstream into public health. So we really need to take an ecosystem approach to USCDI, have an expectation that if there's a data element in USCDI that it's collected, and then also think through the policy levers and incentives for that data to be used downstream into USCDI. So thank you.
All right, the next question is from Les Leonard.
Hi, a comment more than a question. One is that I think that as USCDI progresses, we have to prioritize the patient use case for this, the idea that people could, you know, obtain a standardized amount of clinical data for their own access, for their use on their smartphone or however they want to be able to use it to organize their healthcare records and to do a better job with that. I believe that that's the core of what 21st Century Cures was trying to get us to do, and that while it's super important to be able to do things like quality measures and other things, we have to take on one use case at a time and prioritize that. Second, in my brief time on this committee, I want to point out a tension that I've already seen that is very important. There is a difference between the specifications that are needed for the CCDC format and for doing things as a CCD XML comprehensive summary document for patients and doing things on the FHIR standard, which is much more object-oriented and available piece by piece. That until we resolve this, there's always going to be this inherent problem with the USCDI specification, that what works in the FHIR world may not work very well in the CCD world, and that it's kind of like trying to design a motorcycle and a bicycle at the same time, or, you know, just different vehicles of transportation, things that work in one domain just don't work very well in the other because of the differences in the structure and the implementation of the two approaches. Of course, there's a legacy involved with one that's very important to respect, but I'm just not sure it's possible to optimize for both at the same time. So CCD versus FHIR is going to be an ongoing problem.
Les, let me just respond to your comment about the patient use case and really the patient perspective. We specifically did reach out to identify participants for the task force who have been asked to represent the patient perspective. We have Leslie Kelly Hall, who's joined us and is quite engaged, and we actually just had one member of the task force step down, and we're thinking of inviting yet another patient advocate representative to fill that space who's already been participating in the task force. So I think that there is this keen awareness of the importance of the patient use case and the patient perspective in terms of how USCDI should be moving forward to support all users.
Agreed. I'm just channeling Leslie Kelly Hall as we share the same first name.
All right. The next person in the queue is Clem McDonald.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, we can, Clem.
So I must like a lot of the comments, especially Les's, but I'd like to just highlight a little bit about the quality thing and some issues that might that are peculiar. I was set through all the meetings, or a lot of the meetings where the rules came up. And, you know, there's a couple of things that are positive. You're going to find something wrong. And then there's a gazillion exceptions. And that creates a lot of burden on data collection. And it came out that there's a zillion exceptions. Some people argued, well, let's use it. You know, if you get 90% of it, it's good enough. You know, we're measuring a phenomenon. But some of the big care systems wanted to be as look the best they could possibly look, and wanted all those exceptions. So we kind of shot ourselves in the foot. And I think we got to be careful about the cost of data collection and all this kind of stuff and the burden it puts on. And a couple of rules, I don't know if they're still there, were really stupid. One of them was women would be accepted. They wouldn't have to nurse in the hospital if they had smallpox. They had herpes on their breast. Now, you know, they're going to hold the baby with their hands. No mention about herpes on the hand. And why not just take a diagnosis of herpes? So we got to be a little bit careful of being slavish about some of the quality rules.
Well said, Clem.
Thank you, Clem. And we have Sasha in the queue next.
Good morning. This is Sasha. I wanted to, I guess, build on the comments that Arian made a little bit earlier in the discussion about setting an expectation that anything that's incorporated into USCDI then have an expectation of data capture. Well, I do think that as a mechanism of prioritization, that could be very effective. It seems like we have enough things we should expect capture of that we prioritize those in USCDI first. I do think we're going to need to build nuance into USCDI over time to accommodate the variance in data classes that will be used for more specific purposes and might not be applicable in the current format of HIT certification to every type of product that might be presented for certification. And so as we include types of standards where they might be bidirectional standards where one product plays one role or the other, certification would have to be accommodating of that in a way that the current certification of USCDI is not, right? You have to, as Stephen mentioned, certify to all of the data classes in USCDI, if you will, to any of them. And so I think at some point, and it may not be in USCDI version 2, it may be something we think ahead to USCDI version 3 or 4 or what have you, I do think we'll need to come up with a mechanism in USCDI to say some things are specific to certain scopes, ambulatory or inpatient, or certain specialty scopes, or payer products versus electronic health records, or other types of ways that we would differentiate kind of the expectations for data classes based on the intended use in that way.
And Sasha, that issue or that perspective has been brought forward by many commenters. The idea that, you know, pediatric head circumference is really important if you're taking care of pediatric patients, but if you have a product or a service that doesn't address pediatric patients, pediatric head circumference is not something your system should necessarily need to collect or exchange.
And thank you. We have Michelle Schreiber in the queue next.
Yeah, hi. Thank you. Since there's been a lot of talk about quality measures, I thought maybe I would comment since I lead that at CMS and recognize the many challenges. And actually, in a way, the conversation of USCDI gives me pause, having watched what has happened in the quality measurement space, where we have had a bunch of one-offs, where we have non-standard measures at times. We have non-standard definitions, even of what is diabetes out of control, because people always wanted something different. And we, frankly, were looking to the USCDI to be a way to standardize and hope that we can do that, because otherwise, as we put out quality measures, CMS is going to have to put out definitions that organizations must follow, and then USCDI puts out data element definitions that we have to follow, and we're going to be even more confusing for the ecosystem. You know, regarding the simplification of measures, we are all for it. We have made a commitment that all quality measures will be digital. And to us, this is the path forward, and we are open to reexamining what the definitions and the standards are. I really hope there is one way that we can come to consensus, not that we build something different than USCDI builds something different than another proprietary organization.
And I'll add to that, Michelle, that there have been numerous conversations between ONC and CMS on this topic. We, at your prompting, have scheduled more, and I think that Terry and I, representing the task force, will have, I hope, the opportunity to participate in those to provide a bridge between the task force and that discussion between the federal agencies. But I do think it's very important to get
that
right.
And Les Leonard has his hand up.
I just wanted to say that it would since we're focused on COVID-19 this year, and I'm really glad to hear Mickey say that because it's so that we have some focus. Maybe we should be working out the USCDI V1 and V2 from the perspective of exchanging data about COVID vaccination status, particularly for a population that, we have quality measures there that could be very similar to, influenza vaccine regions. We could have electronic definitions of the cohorts comprise targeted populations, and then, the ability to document receipt of one or two vaccinations from that, all within the context of the USCDI to supply the relevant clinical details, and then, maybe we think about some outcome information as well. So I think that it would be helpful to drive refinement of USCDI from some of these very practical use cases.
All right. Thank you. Stephen, unless you have any final concluding remarks, I don't see any other committee members in the queue.
I'll just close out by saying how happy I am to be able to work with such a great team, both the ONC team and the members of the task force. Terry O'Malley is a wonderful co-chair and has deep appreciation and experience related to this space. And we're looking forward to digging deep into this and bringing back some useful comments to the HITECH.
Thank you, Stephen.
All right, Stephen, thank you again for your leadership there. And this is a fun committee and looks like the conversation is going to be very robust, high-tech discussions, which is great, exactly the whole point of the committee. All right, let's get on with the agenda then. Next, we have Beth Myers and Carmen Smiley related to Project USA. I'll turn it over to you.
Great, thank you. If we can go to the first slide. My name is Beth Myers. I am the Deputy Director of Policy at ONC, and I have the honor of getting to be the policy lead for the Project USA or USAT. However, we haven't worked out the kinks on pronouncing it yet. But that policy role basically means that I get to sit on the sidelines and learn from my tech colleagues a lot. So that's what I'll be doing in this presentation after just a moment of providing some background to you all. I'll be passing to Carmen Smiley, who is the technical lead. I wanted to give a little bit of background to the Federal Advisory Committee on this project, because some of this stems from work that you are all familiar with, from the work that you have done in inputting and reviewing and analyzing our proposed rule in preparation for our final rule, including, apropos to the most recent comment, some of the pieces that we put into the USCDI version 1 and adopted in that rule, including the expansion of demographic information and specifically address. During that rulemaking process for the address field within the USCDI and the demographics data class, we did consider what we heard from multiple commenters about using the existing United States Postal Service Publication 28 and potentially address matching tools to try and come to a more normative, agreed upon address format for healthcare purposes. Our analysis at that time determined that was actually not going to work terribly well. There are some benefits to those resources and tools in terms of giving some basic guidelines around preferred approach for certain types of address formatting, but they really didn't meet the full need that we have for healthcare, where patient matching is such a high issue for patient safety. So because of that, we have been having a lot of dialogue, and in our rule actually sort of indicated this a bit, that we intended to continue to work with the standards community and with healthcare community and with health IT developers to encourage and incentivize the ongoing exploration of address and how we could get to a unified standard normative process consensus based for healthcare purposes that would allow for better address formatting. And that's really what the birth of this project is. So I wanted to give you all that policy background and remind you of this conversation that we had during that rulemaking cycle. And in just a moment, I'm going to pass it off to Carmen Smiley to walk you through the project launch. I did want to make a plug, a shameless plug on the policy end as well, for one more piece, which is that the goal of this project is to come to this address formatting for healthcare and get to that end product. What we'd love to hear from you all and what my team has to consider is where we go from there. How do we ensure the success of this initiative through future endeavors that might encourage or incentivize or support widespread adoption of this particular initiative in this healthcare format to get us to widespread use? So with that, I will pass it off to Carmen Smiley.
Thanks, Beth. Next slide, please. Thanks. So as Beth described, a really important part of this effort is actually the unified nature of the effort. And so this will be the first unified standard in the industry for patient address, which we're really excited about. And we're really touched and excited about the number of partners that we brought on to the project. And so if you've received the slide deck, which I believe you have, there's a link to our Confluence page, which has a list of now over 130 partners that are part of our larger group. And this is a very wide range of partners coming from standards development organizations to health IT vendors to just researchers to just a wide range. And we would like to, and what we're really striving and working hard to do, is to collaborate with them, especially the standards development organizations, because we would like to find ways in which the specification, after it is complete, could be integrated into future versions of standards that are already widely used across the industry. So we're engaging with these partners on a monthly basis. All of you are, of course, welcome to attend those calls. And provide your input, of course, and we'll be at our next call in February. We'll be covering lots of updates from the technical work group, which I'll cover next. We really want to be able to build industry commitment around the specification because we believe if everybody's on board, they have an opportunity to provide input, and we're more likely to increase widespread adoption. And you could argue that it's really more important that we're all doing the same thing than precisely how we're doing it in some ways, which is an interesting approach, I think. And as we mentioned, we really want to reach across the industry. And so some of our partners are involved in immunization registries. Some of them are involved in prescription networks. Some of them are involved at, EHRs or front patient-facing systems. Next slide, please. Thanks. Next slide. So the technical work group, which is a much smaller group, we have about 17 members, which I know is large for a work group, but many of the members are representing the United States Postal Service, and we really appreciate their engagement in this project, especially because where we're starting with the technical work group is with Publication 28. And we are either going to, expand or further constrain it for the purposes of patient matching. That's really important to keep in mind. But our end goal is to improve patient matching success across all of the systems across the industry. So we have representation from the Postal Service, as I mentioned. We also have representation from the CDC. We have two HIEs, some NPI, patient matching vendors, standards development organizations, source groups, and others, technical subject matter experts. We meet on a weekly basis, and as we're going through the specification, the incredible level of expertise and experience from members of the work group is truly impressive. We really appreciate their engagement, volunteering their valuable time to provide input into the development of the specification has really been And our approach, as I mentioned, is that we start with Publication 28. We're also doing a comparison across a number of standards just to be able to depict how addresses are depicted across a number of standards. And we're making some very large sort of big level decisions regarding our scope and small detailed decisions regarding what would be included in the specification. So some examples of, and this is a little bit of a spoiler alert to the February monthly meeting because where we'll be providing updates next. But because of the, we want to be able to do the specification as well as possible and as quickly as possible. So the first phase of the project, which is when we will actually release the final version of Project USA at a specification, we hope to be summer. We know we will finish this year, but the first phase will focus specifically on domestic and military addresses, which falls in line with what Publication 28 guidance provides. And then the second phase, we will then explore the feasibility of addressing international addresses. But we may start with any of the other countries that are physically contiguous to the United States. I believe I mentioned military addresses. I hope that we'll also include those in the phase one. We've also chosen to develop constraints around parsing of data elements for address representation. This is important for matching purposes. There are many standards across the industry that just have one long string that is available to represent address. And we've also discussed metadata representation of both current and historical addresses, any group living situations, because often group living situations will create a high degree of false positives by matching algorithms, because the algorithm may inadvertently think that patient records are duplicates when in fact they are two very different patients. Billing address versus physical or home address, we hope to also find ways to represent that in a way so that systems are able to differentiate or possibly filter between those two, because sometimes those will be different, but most often health systems are focusing on what the billing address is or how the address is represented on the patient's insurance form, or insurance card, rather. And also find ways in which we can indicate that patients are known to be homeless. This is also important for sort of the timeliness of the data, and also helps in matching across otherwise really difficult to identify patients. And right now we're discussing whether or not to include special characters in the specification. And so this has been a really interesting discussion because you always have to think about how the algorithms are reading, how the address is being captured, and if there are hyphens or apostrophes or other characters, it may actually affect the performance of certain, though not all, algorithms. Some algorithms have the capacity to handle it. So we may end up deferring to how the USPS is handling special characters and punctuation. Typically, in their normalization processes, they remove all special characters, including the one between city and state.
Okay.
Next slide.
I'm not speaking or anything.
And just to give you an idea of timeline for the specification, as we mentioned, the final specification, we hope to finish phase one in 2021, and phase two we hope to complete possibly in 2022. But this year we will finalize the Project USA specification for domestic and military addresses. Next slide, please. As I mentioned, there's a link to the Confluence page in your slide deck. You'll find a list of all of our partners, a little bit of background on the project. You'll find a list of everybody that's in the technical work group. You'll find copies of meeting minutes if you aren't able to make all of the meetings and just catch up and keep up with other advancements and where we are in the status of our project. Next slide, please. And I think that is it for me. I apologize for the dog. If anybody has any questions, let us know. And I really appreciate this time. Thank you for having us.
Great job. Excellent. Thank you very much for the presentation. And before we get into questions, I would just remark the importance of some sort of matching, patient matching, whatever, and the barrier and impediment it is, much like some of the other high-tech members were saying, even in the public health emergency. And to give you a real-world example, we're doing contact tracing. We're doing, obviously, the healthcare provider perspective with the hospitals and the clinics and whatnot, and we're providing vaccines. And you'd be amazed at the difficulty it is to match individuals or records or whatnot, and the timeliness and the issues it compounds when now suddenly you have multiple types of vaccines in the market and trying to figure out what that exposure is and where are you as a city. So this is very timely, and I really appreciate the conversation here. All right, so let's get into some questions from the team. The first up, I see Clem McDonald.
Thank you. So can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So there's two issues. One of them is, you know, that nasty question about a national patient identifier, which would maybe reduce the need for this intense, you know, care about matching. And, but I'd like to ask specifically, I had understood that Medicare was working on a Medicare health identifier for their individuals. I'd like to know if that's true or not. But the second thing is, you know, I would worry that if we make a health address specification, if we aren't consistent with the rest of the industry's address specification, we're going to be running upstream. And clearly there are special issues in the health space. But, you know, if you go to UPS or any of the sites or you order something on the web, they correct your address. There's databases and systems behind this that know everything about addresses. So, and it's deep into industry. So I hope we don't conflict with the industry approaches to this just for healthcare.
Great points, Glenn. Thank you very much. Related to the question, Lauren, I don't know if that's something we should work through here or maybe get back to Clem on that question he asked.
Yeah, let's finish going through the questions and then maybe we can have a sidebar with Carmen and team.
Yeah, perfect, perfect. Now we'll get your questions, Clem, answered. Is that okay to you?
Yes, thank you.
Perfect, perfect, okay. So next up then we see Arian.
Hey, so I basically have the same question as Clem. Maybe I'll phrase it slightly differently. I thought the presupposition of Project USATA was that we would be able to leverage the ecosystem of tools that were broadly available for address normalization. And the worry, the concern that I would have is that if we decide that those tools are insufficient because USPS Publication 28 is insufficient, then we're making the mistake of creating a healthcare silo without taking advantage of that ecosystem of rules or of normalization. So, you know, I think it's appropriate to think about special considerations for patient matching that go above and beyond the USPS address normalization. But I think we should also recognize that it is far better to use the ecosystem of tools that exist and then maybe optionally do something on top of them than it is to forego that ecosystem because healthcare is special. Thank you.
Good deal. Beth or any of the team, do you would like to answer that?
Sure, we can, and this actually goes to Clem's question as well. So I will start and then I will make sure that Carmen is filling all of the things that I get slightly off or wrong. But starting from the USPS is actually the foundation for what we're looking at. There are tools out there, including application programming interfaces that the USPS has worked with different industries. Some things that come to mind are banking and things like that, that have taken a look at these types of tools. What we learned from our analysis of these tools is that even while you're using one of those services that you type your address in, it gives you a normative version back, that's actually still a variance. None of those tools are coming to a universal or gold standard, and this is based on work that we've actually done with USPS to try and understand exactly how these tools work and how their various files where they keep gold standards for address connect into those types of tools. So the challenge still becomes that in one location, you can input address into one of those tools using a colloquialism for your local street. Maybe you're using a cardinal direction for your city name in, you know, West whatever city versus that centralized name for that city. And each of those are going to come back with a correct address to which you can have a package delivered. But it wouldn't necessarily be the same address if it's input slightly differently in a different way. So especially when you're looking across networks or across systems, you can end up with, as Carmen mentioned, two different patients being linked together because the address is normalized to something very, very similar, or the same patient having duplicate records that are not being connected and vital health information is being lost. The idea behind this is not to create a new, entirely separate or siloed address format. It's to try and reconcile those variances that currently exist in the tools that are out there so that we can get to a closer, more unified approach to these types of standards for healthcare purposes. So it is, in fact, built on those underlying tools and trying to further reconcile them and further specify them. And I will pass to Carmen to make sure I got that right.
No, that was perfect. Thanks, Beth.
Thank you very much. Very helpful.
All right. So next, I see Jonathan.
Hi, thanks. So I'm Jonathan. I'm the acting CMIO at Veterans Affairs. And as you know, we've been in this business for a long time, having 130 different instances of our EHR for the last probably 30 years. It seems like, I've been working with Pew and other organizations as we're moving our own patient identifiers forward. Is there, I just wanted to foot stomp the last explanation about the problems of the USPS. I live at 1307 Third Avenue, and depending on whether I type in East, there is no West Third Avenue. If I type in East, type an E there or not, I get an entirely different address for the human readable form. But the ZIP plus 4 is still the same. So the is there an effort by ONC to rack and stack the bright ideas in this area with evidence of benefit, and then prioritize, the bright ideas? And this seems like a great, I'm not arguing at all against this, but there's a lot of other bright ideas. And, I'm a fan of multi, identifiers with multiple information, the broadest, information we can get, and then probabilistic matching. I think it's the most accurate and also cheap. But I'd really beg ONC to try to rack and stack priorities against evidence, and then create a plan to get us to a place that's objective and not, full of all the biases that each of us have. So I'll just wonder, maybe that's a question to Elise and company. Is that happened? Because I haven't seen it, and my colleagues in this industry haven't seen it.
ONC team?
I'm pausing to see if Elise or Steve wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, so in the interest of time, maybe Beth, maybe if you want to quickly comment, we can also take this conversation on the side of it. If it's really deep, we can also come back to it.
So it is really deep, and I think that it relates to some work that we are doing more broadly across, frankly, a lot of different initiatives on patient matching and figuring out some of those broader scopes, including the work that Congress directed us to do over the past year related to exploring and analyzing patient matching scenarios across healthcare settings and across the health IT systems. So there is quite a bit of work going on there, and I think we intend to continue that process. I am not one of the ones working on that particular effort, so I am not as well versed on what it is. So I do think a follow-up would be appropriate, and we can dig further in. But I will say this is not being done in a silo. This is a focus on the address piece of it, because obviously loud and clear, and I see that, the Pew link was put in there. We have, in fact, been working and connecting with Pew on this, and they've supported this effort as well. So the piece and focus on address is just one piece of it. We do see the entire larger picture and are working on various efforts in that area.
Yep. Thank you very much. And Jonathan, I will say that in the annual report, we do also call this attention to this issue as related to public health. So perhaps there could be tie-ins there, synergized to really focus on this area in an upcoming high tax. So we can definitely look at that.
Right. And hi, this is Mickey. I just wanted to add, Jonathan, we really appreciate your points on that, and we'll absolutely take a look at that in that context. I think it's a great comment. Thank you.
Thanks. Fantastic. Okay. Jim, I see you next.
I just have a quick question on this. First Nations populations as a fairly large percentage of their population that doesn't have addresses, and I'm wondering whether or not you've thought of how to not marginalize that population further within this effort.
This is Carmen. I'd like to answer that if possible. So as I mentioned, I believe before the phase one of the project, we'll be doing domestic and military addresses. And phase two will be international addresses plus geolocation data. So my mother lives in an area where she doesn't have a physical address as well, and she's sort of, you know, in that same area of the country. I completely understand the need and the value that it would bring. We simply just need a little bit more time to delve into it and to ensure that that data could be supported, because everything that we consider, of course, we also have to consider feasibility for adoption. But we're certainly not ignoring it, and I appreciate the comment.
Actually, I think that's a great question, and also to add to that, there are different other socioeconomic challenges, people living together, large families living under one roof, one address. If we start using this as the only primary key to link people, you could have challenges there. But as I've always said in these high-tech meetings, any direction forward is good direction, so I applaud ONC and Carmen, your work there, and Beth, your work there. Next on the list here, we have Abby Sears.
Hi, I was actually going to ask something similar to Jim, but I'm going to expand on his question as well. Yeah, our patient population has a higher propensity of testing positive for COVID. They have a higher propensity of being some of the most complex patients in the entire system and some of the most expensive to treat. And they have the highest propensity to not match when we move their data to other parts of the delivery system, often because of the nomenclature on their names and surnames, but also because of address challenges, and not just because they don't live in a location where there's an address, but because they are mobile. So if you're looking at seasoned migrant workers, they don't have a single location where they're living, and it changes from time to time, and it's difficult to keep track of. So if that becomes a major component of the tracking and the patient identification process that we're going to use as a country, I think we're going to miss some of the most expensive and complex and challenged patients, and we're going to actually add to the divide around diversity and equity and inclusion that we have as an inherent challenge in the system. And I know I'm bringing up a topic that is incredibly difficult to solve, but I'm just curious what you had thought about related to that, because I don't think geo mapping is going to solve that. So have you given any thought to that, Carmen?
Yes. Hey, Kathy, it's Carmen. We have thought about it a great deal, and I don't want to give the impression that we're putting, you know, we're assuming that geolocation or geomapping would answer many of the challenges that we face. But we also have to consider tiny little victories that do add up, that do make a difference. So I think the combination of geolocation data, considering, you know, also street names and address information that's in other languages. And we're not addressing patient names. We're staying laser focused on patient addresses for this purpose or for this specific project. But we're certainly considering, and we're working closely with USPS, as Beth had mentioned, to, you know, understand how they handle packages or, you know, mailing to sort of casual or non-specific addresses. And I hope you'll tune into our next partner meeting, and so that you can receive some updates on our ongoing progress.
And this is Beth, just to add the sort of the broader comment that we made earlier as well. That, again, as Carmen mentioned, this is laser focused on this particular piece. We are not saying this is the only piece, and we are not intending for this to become sort of a magic bullet. We don't believe that it is. We think that this is one part of the puzzle, that there are challenges and that those challenges can be addressed. So we are specifically, no pun intended, addressing those challenges. But there is the broader picture, and there are conversations that we are part of and that we're learning more and more about as we go. About, you know, how many, even if we're just talking about address and beyond the actual normative standard for the address format itself, how many past addresses are we storing? How are we connecting those together for individuals? What other types of information? How many data points can we get to ensure that we're getting appropriate match, including things like race and ethnicity that can help with some of the risk scoring that we've been talking about for COVID? So I think there's bigger pieces to this, and we're very much trying to focus on getting this piece more correct and more useful.
Well said. Thank you very much. So I just want to ask again, any other questions from the committee members? Looking for any hands?
Okay.
Do we have anybody just on the phone, Aaron?
Oh, thank you. Yes. Yeah, no, thank you for asking.
Anybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's anybody just on the phone. Okay.
All right. No, good catch. Thank you. I was looking for hands. You're right. We got folks on the phone that can't raise their hands, so thank you for that. Well, as I was saying, Beth, Carmen, ONC team, high five to all of you. This is a very deep topic that you can tell we are all very passionate about from our perspectives. So please keep up the good work and continue to trek forward and enlightening us. And we look forward to further talking about this and other topics related to it. So great job. Okay, so keeping on, and we are running a little ahead, which is good, actually, so we can go back for discussion much later on, is related to the START HIE program progress. And I believe up first with this, we're going to have a multi-phase approach here with various speakers and different wonderful organizations. We're going to start with Larry Jessup.
Larry, I can hear you.
Yes, sir.
Can you hear me? All right, great. Good afternoon, everyone.
Yes, we can hear you now, Larry.
Excellent. Thank you, Denise. I would like to begin by saying that we are very excited about this program and proud of the work done so far. And it goes without saying that every awardee of the STAR HIE program, similar to all of you, are supporting the country in the COVID-19 response effort while also being confronted with this issue in their communities and with their families and friends. So this work is greatly appreciated. And again, as I mentioned, my name is Larry Jessup, and I am a branch chief in the State and Interoperability Innovations Branch in the ONC Office of Policy, and I lead the team of individuals who are responsible for the day-to-day managing of this award. The STAR HIE program was designed to strengthen uses of health information via HIEs to support public health agencies, including in their COVID-19 response. So as you all are aware, there was about $5 million from the CARES Act, which was signed March 27, 2020, that came our way for this program, and this was announced in two buckets, if you will. The first bucket was announced on September 30th, 2020, and this was $2.5 million to support five HIEs in creating services that benefit public health agencies. On January 19th of 2021, there was a supplement of $2.5 million, and this just essentially meant that we were able to supplement four of the original five HIEs with $123,000. And this also allowed us to award $123,000 to an additional 17 HIEs, increasing our total award recipients to 21 health information exchanges in total, all with the goal as part of this supplement to specifically support increased data sharing between immunization information systems and HIEs. The ultimate goal of this program as a whole, however, is to do two things. The first is to build innovative health information exchange services that benefit public health agencies. So by strengthening the existing health information exchange infrastructure with these innovative services, we believe that will allow public health agencies to better access, share, and use health information. The second goal is to improve the health information exchange services available to support communities disproportionately impacted by the COVID-19 pandemic. This pandemic has further exposed the many health inequities that exist across certain patient demographic groups, and we'll be working to minimize these gaps in quality of care that is delivered as well. As you all have heard us say, we are very confident in the ability of the HIEs to align with public health agencies to conduct this work. And this is important because we recognize that the extensive clinical data held by HIEs are in many cases not accessible by public health agencies. So we want to make sure that in everything we are doing, we are supporting public health agencies by making sure they are able to utilize the services that HIEs are well situated to provide. For example, we know that HIEs serve as data hubs from a multitude of sources. We know that HIEs have a strong understanding of and experience with local healthcare environments, including the policies that dictate use for public health agencies. And we also know that HIEs actively support public health agencies with public health reporting and even improving data quality. So in the end, we want to make sure that the public health agencies have the necessary data and health information to respond and recover from current and future public health events. Given where we found ourselves as a country in late December and early January, as it relates to the increased role that immunization information systems are playing, we were excited that federal dollars were available to fund the additional 17 recipients to support efforts to increase data sharing between jurisdictional immunization information systems and health information exchanges. So the STAR HIE program now includes more specific clinical and population health efforts, which includes making improvements to, for instance, the ability to identify high-risk patients who have not yet received the vaccination, improving the methods for tracking and supporting COVID-19 vaccination administration, and also includes monitoring long-term health effects, adverse reactions, and reinfection rates across entire populations. So when you think about this holistically with everything we are doing with ONC, this is just a plug here that this also speaks to the importance of the work we are doing with the Trust Exchange Framework and Common Agreement to ensure that the appropriate technical and legal infrastructure exists across the country for the broad sharing of health information to occur, particularly during public health emergencies. So with that, I would like to introduce you all to those who are actually doing this critical work out in the field. And you will first hear from the Texas Health Services Authority. They are piloting a national strategy for hospital situational awareness information. We have Phil Beckett, who is the CEO of HASA, which is a health information exchange in Texas covering multiple regions. And we also have Eric Heflin, who is the CTO and CISO of the Texas Health Services Authority. Once Eric concludes, he will turn it over to their partners on this cooperative agreement, HealthShare Exchange Pennsylvania. They are supporting COVID-19 response in the Delaware Valley, and we have Bill Morella, who is the Director of Data Analytics and Quality, and we also have Elizabeth Scholes, who is the Project Manager. So just very special thanks to these individuals. They have been nothing short of fantastic thus far, so I'm honored to kick it off to Phil and Eric. So thank you all.
Well, thank you, Larry, and this is Eric Heflin, TSA. And with that awesome introduction, actually, we'll skip a few of our slides. Just a quick audio check. Is my audio okay?
Yes, we can hear you.
Okay, very good. Okay, so if you could go to the next slide. So we're going to, Phil and Dr. Beck and I are going to talk about, is very briefly and very quickly touch on a few key points about the details of the program that Larry just really announced and introduced quite elegantly. So we're going to talk really about THSA's statewide perspective on health exchange within Texas. Just going to touch on it very briefly, one slide, and then talk about the, skip over the sections about the cooperative agreement, leave those three references really before we cover that, and then drill down a little bit of the details, the technical details, business case, use case, you know, the, how we can help patients and any, and providers as well, too, towards a quadruple aim, which Dr. Beck will talk more about that as well. And also, you know, our goal is to be a pilot, really share both positive and negative lessons learned with the rest of the country. And so we're going to start some of that today as well, sharing, you know, some challenges that we can maybe work on together. And then we'll switch over to Dr. Beckett's presentation, talking about a perspective for a large multi-region health information exchange within Texas. If you go to the next slide. So I also want to thank Larry Jessup for his incredible support, and also Dr. Tara Tesler just for her outstanding work in, on program management. And you know, I know we already have finished the topic about U.S. address, but also want to thank Carmen Smiley for involving Texas in that as well, too. We found it to be very helpful to make sure that we have really real-world you know, in involvement perspectives that we can offer, and I hope we all can build each other's shoulders for that. So I'll leave this slide for your reference, and there's a link down at the bottom for those on slide three that actually has the announcement of the STAR program, STAR HIE program. Go to the next slide, please. So the Texas Health Services Authority was actually largely created to help, you know, foster connectivity like this. So we actually were awarded this cooperative agreement program on September 30th, and we're very happy to be a very strong advocate and participant within this process. And so the THSA's kind of role in this project really is to act as the award recipient, but also really to act as the coordinator among multiple organizations that are involved with this project, including our very strong partner, HASA, that Dr. Beckett runs, as well as working with industry standards bodies as well, too. Again, we're trying to create something that hopefully will be a pilot and serve, hopefully, again, as a model for the United States, to allow hospitals to report their situational awareness data in close to real time to public health authorities throughout the country and throughout the state as well, too. If you go to the next slide, please. So the real technical objectives or clinic and workflow objectives of this project are to provide hospital measures reporting, and this is designed to be configurable. So it's not a one and done and we're stuck with that approach. The intent is for this to be flexible. And so we're establishing a pattern and technologies that are designed to be for future-proof to a large extent. For example, if another epidemic were to occur with different characteristics or another national disaster or even a state disaster, this program would allow for those measures to be configured on the fly with the stakeholders. Exchange hospital capacity information with public health. Another project is really to reduce the burden to hospitals. Today, some of these measures are conveyed, but many cases they're manual. And we hear from our valued hospital colleagues that they're very burdensome for the hospital to report to public health. And so part of the objective here very explicitly is to make this burden really go away and to automate this process, if not 100%, very close to 100%. We also want to reduce time lag. Right now, as I mentioned, some of these processes are manual. And, of course, manual processes have a lot of baggage associated with them, right? It includes, the rekeying, potentially, or OCRing, scanned images. And those are time-consuming. They're expensive in terms of human resources. They introduced accuracy issues and time delay issues. And so we're trying to really address all those in one fell swoop. In addition, we're looking at this being an open standard. We're participating for the public good. We're trying to create something that the country can build on and learn from our successes and our mistakes, which we'll certainly have some. And so we're trying to, among other things, build this upon international and United States-based standards. I mentioned in the slide being presented down number 5 for me following along remotely. We're involved very heavily with HL7 and their fire work group. And also IHE USA, which is a standards body designed to, for those not familiar with it, to essentially to take lower level standards and to create a higher level standard on top of those to kind of stitch the lower level standards together into things like a complete clinical workflow. For example, cross document sharing across health information exchanges or with the public and private sector and so on. So we work very closely with both IHE USA as well as HL7 to make sure that these standards were publicly vetted. Everything is transparent. There is no undue influence from any one particular stakeholder. That basically have a very balanced, transparent, and open process. So nothing about this development was hidden. It was all out in the public, and I think we're going to be stronger because of that process, which was sometimes painful. But it's worthwhile to make sure that the end result has critical assessment and analysis, especially now while we're still in the design phase. And we found there was a gap in terms of standards. And so we worked with our valued partner, Audacious Inquiry, and HL7 to remediate that gap. And we've created a new one together called SANER, which is a situational awareness for the novel epidemic response. But it really can be used for more than just for COVID. That just happens to be the current, obviously very, very important driver. And this also project is intended, frankly, to build on existing federal investments into health information exchanges. There has been a lot of funds invested over the last number of years to help build out EMRs, to help build out health information exchanges. And so this is intended to reuse and leverage those existing investments. Next slide, please. So the THSA, we were the formal recipient. We actually are an authority, which means that in a layperson's terms, I'm a techie, not an attorney, but it essentially means we are like an agency, a state agency, but we don't promulgate regulations, and we are actually exist in the private sector as a 501c3 nonprofit. And that is very important because basically that lets us straddle both sides, and we can talk to our colleagues as a somewhat peer agency, and we can talk in the private sector as a private sector entity as well, too. So it lets us kind of bridge that gap between private and public exchange. And that lets us be nimble. It lets us react very quickly to changes, lets us take advantage of opportunities like this with ONC and with HASAN and others. Our mandate here is to foster secure healthcare exchange connectivity within Texas. And we use a multi-pronged approach. I won't go into that in details, but it's available on our website. Our benefit, those that we're trying to benefit includes the citizens of the state, the individual patients and consumers and people, but also to help providers. We want to make sure that this is helps them, help us, be treated better. We want to make sure that, this is not going to be burdensome to the humans or to the organizations that are involved in treating patients as well, too. Matter of fact, this hopefully will have the opposite objective and, in fact, will reduce their burden substantially by automation. And we also are trying to connect to public health and help our state and federal agencies as well, too, get better data faster, more accurate, so that they can benefit and help us as well, too. And I will mention our partners in this include HIEs in Texas, specifically HASA, the Texas Department of State Health Services, Medicaid, Texas Hospitals. We're working with our partners over there, Texas Hospital Association and Texas Medical Association, and then also with the CDC and others as well, too. Next slide. The very highest level objective is to pilot real-time automated hospital capacity gathering and then to share that. Some of the areas we're focusing on are including standards, as I mentioned, discussing security considerations and privacy considerations to make sure this is indeed meets those objectives or exceeds objectives. We are starting getting public feedback and comments on these areas to make sure that that anybody that wants to have a voice in this process, that they are heard. And we're also dealing with policy and legal issues as well, too. Next slide. This is one and probably my only slide for the techies out there. So this is actually a conceptual architecture of how the data actually would flow. Since I'm a techie, I apologize. I just felt like I had to drop at least one somewhat technical slide here as well, too. So the components of the SANR project include a reporting component, and that generates the data. We have a presentation component that actually will visualize it. We have an adapter, which specifically goes between the hospital EMR systems and a FHIR server. We have a client FHIR server, a FHIR client and server, and then there's also a database component. And if you look on the right-hand side of slide 38 here, what would happen typically as far as a data flow is the hospital, in this normal course of business, would probably track inventory, would track immunizations, would track beds that are used, beds available, and so on. And the expectation is that there would be an API, an applications programmer interface, which is lingo for a way to automate systems between the hospital and the intermediary, which is represented by the middle box. So what would happen is the hospital would send or make available the capacity information, such as number of beds available, ICUs free, ICUs busy, ventilators available. It could even include more information, such as about some of the quality metrics previously discussed today. And that information would go to our partner, HASA. HASA, and that would act as aggregator. So they would get data from all of the regions HASA serves within Texas. They would aggregate that data, quality assure it, and then push it up to HIE Texas, or Texas Health Services Authority, using secure HIPAA-compliant connections, of course. And then we would furthermore make that data available to public health agencies. And again, the intent here is for this all to be based on industry standards and all automated to the largest extent possible, discrete data, and all in close to real time. Next slide, please. So the current status of the project is we've been working really with our partner, Audacious Inquiry, with NHL7 to create the SANR standard. It's available for review right now on HL7, various publication sources. We tested it January 21st. I'm getting an echo. My audio is still. Is my audio okay at this point still? Can everybody hear me okay? Okay,
yep,
I see a transcript.
Yep, yep. Whoever was creating the issue.
Okay, very good. Thank you. We tested this at the January 2021 HL7 a testing event, which they call a Connectathon. Someone else mentioned that earlier. That's a really a very valuable activity. And what a Connectathon is, for those that are not engaged in this domain much, is basically all of the vendors, all the partners and potentially customers and so on actually come together. And often it's a physical room. Lately, of course, it's been a virtual room. And we basically focus on testing a workflow. In this case, we actually had a Connectathon focus or a track focused just on SANR. And so we actually had a couple of EMR vendors, we had AI, we had ourselves and some others as well too, all at the table really to test and to make sure that we had some actual data flowing between actual test systems representing EMRs and representing the FHIR servers in the prior diagram I just showed you. And that was successful. We did prove out some connectivity was established. And our plan is to continue this testing at the IHE USA North America Connectathon, which again is virtual, and that starts the first week of March. So that's going to build on the HL7 Connectathon, and our goal is to try to recruit more EMR vendors to be engaged with us at that testing event to really make sure we have multiple EMRs, so it's technology neutral. And then we are also seeking to test more measures. If you go to the next slide. As far as challenges and next steps, I promised earlier we'd start sharing both positive and negative lessons learned. So, you know, the positive lesson learned is we have established some data flow with an actual EMR and hope to establish more next month. Challenge, we actually have two Texas laws that are kind of, you know, constraints we have to be aware of. One is related to data flow for immunizations data, and the other is data flow or, and use of the data with the Texas Health Services in particular. So we're just working with stakeholders around and finding ways to support these constraints. The very next steps is we're seeking to onboard more pilot hospitals we're seeking to continue SANR testing in coordination with HASA, HL7, HUSA, and then, of course, our valued partner in this process, AI. So with that, let me please turn it over to my peer and colleague, Dr. Phil Beckett. And thank you.
Thanks, Eric. Appreciate it. And I may be the one causing the echo, but if my audio, I might have to go old-fashioned, but if the audio is good, I'll start. If you go to the next slide, please. I really, talking about, you know, we're a not-for-profit local health information exchange here in Texas, covering several regions, San Antonio, Dallas, Fort Worth, Corpus Christi, West Texas, where our mission is around the quadruple aim, so improving outcomes and reducing costs, and also improving the healthcare experience both for patients and providers. So I say that just so you know our thinking, where we're coming from. We're always trying to partner both with Texas Health Services Authority, with Eric's team, with AI, with other vendors, and also with our hospital, health plan, and physician partners to what are the local goals, what are you trying to do, how are you trying to change outcomes within our mission to do that. So we're always thinking workflow. As well, you know, health information exchanges vary in where they get their revenue. In Texas, we get this all from subscription fees, so we really have to focus on what's the value, and we think about that as well, I think, in reference to the SANA project. How do we help Texans and our partners through doing this? Go to the next slide, please. So what is HASA? We have a centralized data model, so physicians, hospitals, health plans send us data, which we store in a patient's longitudinal record. You were talking earlier about the MPI issues. You know, we have those too. How do we have a single record for a patient? We're a community partner, so really, how do we work with local governance, local goals? What are people trying to do? How do we help support them? We have a very agile platform, so we try to meet everybody where they are. So if a hospital can send us a flat file, you know, a CSV file to an SFTP server, we'll pick that up. We'll turn it into Fire API and try to be that Swiss Army knife between and push the standards at our level, but still in empowering and enabling our customers to go at the level that they can go at until they reach those standards. And we're also value-driven, again. The only way we survive is if we deliver value back to our partners. Next slide, please. This is just a map of where we are now across Texas. These are primarily hospital and physician groups. We have about 9 million unique patients in our Master Patient Index today, so that's about a third of the population, or just under a third of the population in Texas. Next slide. We think nationally, so we're connected through the patient-centered data home, which is a strategic health information exchange collaborative initiative where we share demographic data based on zip code. So if a patient, for example, goes to a clinic in Oklahoma, but they have a Texas address, that Oklahoma My Health Access Network will send us a notification to HASA, hey, we have data on your patient, so that now we can share clinical data between us. Based on that. So between all the health information exchanges, we've become a national network. One connection gets you the data on your patients across the whole country. And then the next slide, please. We are also connected to the eHealth Exchange, you know, again, supporting the national networks. The DOD and the VA connection is very important to us in Texas. A lot of those facilities, a lot of veterans that go to both VA facilities and civilian facilities. So having that crossover, that interoperability is a key value proposition. Next slide. This is my equivalent of Eric's techie slide, but really kind of what we do is at the top level is adding value to external events is the way I think about it. So on the left, we have our stakeholders, hospitals, physician groups sending us data in whatever format they can. We always ask for FHIR, but if that's not possible, we'll meet them where they are. We get all kinds of data that way. We pass it out. We normalize it. You know, healthcare data is very variable. So we'll standardize, for example, patient type. So emergency is always emergency, however it's coded locally. We have a master person index. We store that data. We analyze it. And then we turn around and deliver it, again, in multiple formats. But thinking about the SANA project, on the left, you've got resources, information coming into us from a hospital, we can turn around and expose that as a FHIR API with Audacious Inquiry and Texas Health Resources, Texas Health Services, sorry, I'm sorry. The next slide, please. I wanted to just get a couple of local use cases, again, how we're thinking and partnering with our group. We have an FQHC here in San Antonio. Communicare, they are really trying to reduce preventable admissions in pregnancies. So what we do with them, one, we're validating models. So they've got models for what is a high-risk mom, and then we're going back and looking through the data and saying, mapping their risk category to the number of ED visits, preventable ED visits, and to improve the models. But then also, the whole goal is we can notify them about external events so that in the end, they can prevent that admission rather than catching it afterwards. We're doing a lot of, obviously there's a lot of work on COVID-19 today, so we're tracking status on that, both infection and immunization. A lot of hospitals asking us for that information. We provide that back to them real time. We're also doing a collaboration with the University of Texas Austin and the Health Information Exchange there, ICC, and a clinic in Austin on vaccine forecasts. So again, in your own electronic health record, you have a limited data set of what you've seen on that patient. If you add to that what the Health Information Exchange has from the community, you can put together a much more personalized forecast of what immunizations that patient might need. So we're doing that also with STC. So I just wanted to put those out there as some examples of what we're doing today to kind of drive that mission in partnership with others. And then next slide, please. This is how we're envisioning the STAR SANA project. So we've got the hospital on the left. They've got multiple systems where they need to send data to us around resources. We'll accept those in multiple formats, however they can get it to us. And just as I showed you on that other map, we'll clean that up. There's got to be a validation and review process, an approval process. Obviously, concerns about resources and effects on elective processes that drive revenue. But then send. Now that's the FHIR format. And again, this is the HIE. I'm including Texas Health Services Authority Audacious Inquiry in that center block. And then we expose that as FHIR back to the health department. So now they're seeing one standard, it's real time. And we're leveraging both the existing technology connections that we have underneath and the existing governance agreements that we have. We've got business associates agreements with all these. We don't have to go and rebuild that. We can leverage all of that existing, both governance and technology infrastructure. Then the next slide. So what we're, again, we're thinking of this, and thanks to ONC and support and this grant, one, obviously reducing that manual administrative burden of reporting. How much of this can we automate while keeping the checks and balances and guardrails in place? Retain local independence and control of what that report content is. Leverage existing infrastructure. And then at the public health end, faster access to more accurate digital data. I know I talked to one of our local health departments, and they had come in every morning to a stack of facts, which in 2021 is strange, but it happens. And if we can get more of that digital so we have less manual reentry, we start to reduce the administrative burden on both ends of this process. So that's our goal. And the next slide, please. I will there pass, we're going to save questions to the end. Thank you again for the opportunity to talk with you all, and I'll hand it over to Bill.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Well, thank you. Before we start the next presentation, we do have a few questions, or would you prefer to hold those till the end? I'll leave that up to to all the presenters.
No preference here from Eric, whatever the unseen organizers would prefer.
Okay. Well, we just have a couple of questions that it might be smoother to just go ahead and have them ask their questions now and then start your presentation. Les, Leonard's in the queue, if you could.
I'd rather wait for Ben, to be honest. It's more of a policy question.
Okay. How about Abby? Is your question specific to Texas's presentation?
Looks like she dropped her hand.
Oh, yeah, she dropped her hand. Okay, let's continue. I apologize for interrupting.
All right. Hi, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Yes. Oh,
okay,
we can.
Great. Great. Thank you. Thank you for inviting us to address you this morning. So my name is Bill Morella. I'm Director of Data Analytics and Quality at HealthShare Exchange. So we are the HIE that's serving, we'd say, the Delaware Valley. So for us, that's basically southeastern Pennsylvania, as well as southern New Jersey and northern Delaware. And we can go to and I'm going to be joined by my colleague, Liz Scholes, who's helping to manage this project with ONC. You can go to the next slide. So before I get into this, I do want to say a quick word of just thanks to ONC for having the vision to understand what HIEs could bring to the COVID-19 response. We've been really energized by what is a crisis that hopefully none of us will have to live through again. But our membership has really rallied around us and gotten behind the activities that we're doing here. So I think we had something like 35 letters of support for our application to ONC. And I think all of our members also understood, the data assets that HSX is custodian of and how we could leverage those to achieve some of the goals that we had for population health. So thanks to ONC for having that vision and thanks to Larry and Tara Tessier, who have been helping us navigate this process as we've gotten the cooperative agreement started. So I'm not going to spend any time telling you about HIEs. I'm assuming everyone on this committee is very familiar with that. What I will say about our network that's a little bit unique is we have pretty much saturated the market in terms of the providers and the health plans in our area, and we've really moved now to the point where most of the people we're bringing on today are post-acute care organizations and community organizations that are addressing things like social determinants of health. We've brought on a number of the area agencies on aging over the last year, bringing on some more this year, and other community service organizations that are addressing those sorts of social needs. So I think we really are at the point where we're breaking down a lot of the silos that exist between the different parties that all have relationships with the patients. Next slide, please. Real quick about our network. So we have about 12 million patients in our clinical data repository, and including not only Pennsylvania residents or residents of the Delaware Valley, but also people who are coming here for care. So we do have a national draw because of the institutions in our area. We've got about 16,000 physicians and other mid-level practitioners that are in our provider directory. And we've got about 450 different organizations that are connected to HSX in one way or another. Next slide. So I just want to paint a quick picture of sort of where we started on this project and what things were like back in the early days of, for us, it was around March and April when the pandemic really started to take off. And at that point, the public health agencies in our area, we had a relationship with the Philadelphia Department of Public Health, but really none of the outlying counties outside Philadelphia. And a couple informal connections, we were hearing things like they were literally getting, a couple of people have mentioned faxes. They were getting faxes one patient at a time with individual lab results that they were manually typing into Excel spreadsheets. And fortunately, we were able to convince them to change their approach and start consuming the data that we could make available to them. And even beyond sort of the COVID pandemic, we're at a point now in the evolution of HIEs nationally, where I think all of us are at the point of doing some higher order things than simply moving data around sort of for that transactional, patient level view. And, you know, some of the things that we're doing are around disease management, like projects we're doing on diabetes or matching seniors with benefit programs that they're eligible for. It's a partnership we have with the Department of Aging in Pennsylvania. And even before the ONC cooperative agreement came through, we had started developing the Delaware Valley COVID-19 registry. And some of our members are accessing that data to be able to answer questions like, if I look at patients who have come through our emergency department and were diagnosed with COVID that we sent home, did any of those people wind up getting admitted somewhere else later? Those are the kinds of quality improvement types of studies that this data will enable. And with that, I'll ask you to go to the next slide, and I'll turn this over to my colleague, Liz Scholes, who's going to walk you through the outline of our project with ONC.
Thanks, Bill. Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity to present this morning. As Bill mentioned, I do just want to add that, while HSX has access to the clinical data on millions of patients, from our origins, it's been HSX's mission to be a community asset. So what we'd really like to highlight today is, with the help of grants and collaborations such as this one, HSX has been propelled into incredible opportunities in this last year that ensure that we are that data-sharing community asset that can support large-scale population health initiatives. It's given us a new opportunity to focus on data quality and analytics like we've never done before and explore new types of data connections that benefit public health agencies and the larger community. So the two main objectives of the STAR-HIE program are to build innovative HIE services benefiting public health agencies and improve HIE services available to support communities disproportionately affected by COVID-19. So in partnership with our local public health agencies, our members, and our board of trustees, we've developed a strategic portfolio of activities that will close gaps for our region's public health response to COVID-19 and prepare us for future threats. So this slide illustrates our four main areas of focus under this program. So what we really plan to do is modernize our region's pandemic response by exploring new opportunities for data exchange, as you see up in this left-hand corner, that includes augmenting the ability to do case finding, contact tracing, and sharing immunization status. HSX is participating in that Robert Wood Johnson COVID-19 registry, and we are facilitating public health agency use of that tool. So Bill will share more information later in the presentation, but in response to a request from the Philadelphia Department of Public Health and the Office of Emergency Management, HSX was able to create a dashboard of emergency department and inpatient volumes and activity. HSX is also committed to implementing new data connections based on public health priorities, including electronic lab reporting to local and state agencies, and connecting to the American Public Health Laboratory AIMS platform for ECR reporting, as well as implementing new CCD feeds. HSX has a unique opportunity to close information gaps for our local public health agencies and our broader membership with data that's already at our disposal through existing HIE connections. We're enhancing our infrastructure with new capabilities and adding new data feeds that will fill many of the current gaps in public health surveillance systems. One of the big priorities for HSX was to establish a governance necessary to not just put COVID-19, the emergency, to respond to the COVID-19 emergency, but also to put structures in place so our efforts can persist after the emergency is behind us. So in doing so, HSX created a steering committee that's comprised of HSX leadership and the public health agencies benefiting from this program to help govern and guide priorities. This approach includes our state, city, and local public health organizations ensure alignment and success of the activities outlined in this program. Next slide, please. So for the purpose of this presentation, we'd really like to drill down into the new data connections, as these are initiatives that are largely new to HSX since the pandemic began, and this effort has drastically improved data sharing with public health agencies. New data connections are automating previously manual processes, which improves reporting and reduces the burden on providers. As Bill mentioned previously, we heard records were faxed over one patient at a time. There was a lot of manual collection being needed, and it was just largely inefficient, and it could too many options for user error. Demographic information may come over incorrect or missing altogether. The ONC STAR HIE grant has allowed HSX to facilitate meaningful, timely, and more complete and accurate information sharing with our local agencies. Next slide, please. So this slide here, we included to illustrate the new data connections that HSX has either completed or is working on since receiving the ONC STAR HIE grant. It's important for me to just point out that the names listed on this slide are large health systems within our region, and each of them have multiple acute or ambulatory facilities under that umbrella. So prior to the pandemic, ELRs were not going to the city of Philadelphia, or for the few that were, it happened infrequently, such as once daily. That's not very actionable or timely information that is useful for the city. So the request through this project was to make that a more timely, actionable feed. And today, the ELR feed from HSX to the city is in production, and we just have a few more organizations to onboard. We achieve this one of two ways, either utilizing the ELR feed that the member currently sends to the state and creating a new destination to the city, or working from the existing direct lab feed we receive from the member and filtering that feed by COVID-19 LOIN codes and the Philadelphia resident zip code. Electronic case reporting is beneficial for both providers and public health agencies. HSX had never before supported transmission of this type of data, but now has the opportunity to do so under this grant. HSX is piloting the project with Temple Health and hopes to have it in production in the next few weeks. As you all know, consolidated clinical documents are the rich, robust information that allow for more informed, quality patient care. And CCDs contain that immunization details that are extremely valuable for this pandemic and beyond. HSX is committed to increasing the number of CCD connections across our region. Along those lines, the final data connection I'd like to point out on this slide is connecting to our state and local immunization information systems. In the state of Pennsylvania, there are multiple registries, but there are currently barriers in place, and HSX believes we can improve upon those. HSX has made it a priority to enhance data sharing capabilities and ensure that our providers and public health agencies have access to the data that they need. Next slide, please. So this slide we included just to illustrate some of the other onboarding initiatives we have going on in 2021. It's important to note that these are under the PA state grant, not ONC, but that the COVID-19 work that we're doing today definitely benefits them indirectly. This slide actually is a little bit outdated, but what I can say is HSX is working on receiving at a minimum CCDs, as I mentioned previously, from various skilled nursing facilities, urgent cares, home health, primary care providers, specialty care providers across the entire state of PA. We're working on increasing our branches beyond where we are today to add depth and richness to our data and close gaps for those facilities in the region. Next slide, please. So electronic case reporting automates a currently manual process via a module update within the provider EHR. So over here on the left, we have the providers, and if the provider inputs a trigger, which can be a diagnosis, a problem, an order, lab test, lab result, medication, or immunization, an ECR will be generated. From those triggers, the system identifies possible reportable conditions and automatically sends that ECR XML to HSX. HSX then passes that information to APHL Ames, where an algorithm determines if the condition is reportable. APHL AIMS sends the reportability response to the appropriate public health agencies based on where the care was provided and the patient residence, and also to HSX. HSX shares that document back with the source facility. Today, there are two mechanisms for submitting ECRs to APHL, one being eHealth Exchange, or the other direct secure messaging. And we do intend to persist confirmed reportability responses in our clinical data repository, but we're still working through the technical details of how that will perform. Next slide, please. HSX is honored and grateful to have received the Immunization Information Systems ONC Star HIE Supplemental Award to connect to our state and local registries. As I mentioned previously, we have a number of registries in our state, and there are barriers in place that we really believe that we can help improve upon. So at a high level, some of the immunization priorities that we have to tackle are listed on this slide. HSX aims to connect with our state registry via HL7 query and retrieve, and we plan to share vaccine data with and between our registries as well to improve information sharing. Finally, HSX hopes to receive from the registries a file of COVID vaccination administration limited to patients within our community. Next slide, please. Finally, this slide is a screenshot of a record within the HSX clinical data repository that illustrates how immunization data gets parsed into our system. HSX has started receiving some COVID vaccine data, and we are receiving the appropriate CDX code, and the data is parsing correctly from the facilities that we received from so far. Bill, before I hand it over and we move on to the next slide, do you have anything you'd like to add about immunization?
As you said, even the registries that are operating within our jurisdiction are not necessarily sharing information consistently with one another. So in addition to being able to get that data into HSX so that the providers and the payers have access to it, we also want to make sure that we're helping the public health agencies that run the registries. So that's a big part of that. Thanks, Liz. So we can go to the next slide, please. So I just want to drill down a little bit and talk about some of the other aspects of our program. So, we're just to give you a sense of where we are in the pandemic. We are just coming off of the second wave, which, as you can see through the stats here, was even larger than the first, but we managed it a lot more successfully and with a lot less pain than the first one. And, everything is shifting now to getting needles in arms. So that's really the front line of everyone's COVID response. So, in Pennsylvania, I think we've got over 1 million people have had at least their first vaccination, not quite 1 million yet in New Jersey. And, of course, everything's hinging on the supply. But, we feel like we're in a good place now. And, the caseload is certainly manageable at this point, having come down from the second wave. Next slide, please. So really throughout the pandemic, we've been doing surveillance reports to basically, to borrow Eric's phrase, provide some situational awareness to our members. They were all familiar with the numbers they were reporting into the local public health authorities, but in the early days especially, they weren't really getting a lot of information back to let them know what was going on even in their immediate vicinity. So we tried to fill that gap and, and also did some analyses using some diagnoses that CDC identified as indicating people who would be at high risk should they get COVID. And we were able to map, those diagnoses to the people in our master patient index. And, indeed, we saw that people who had more of these risk factors had, twice the risk of getting hospitalized if they got COVID, four times the mortality risk and longer length of stay. So we're now translating that into a risk index that we can augment our MPI with. So we've been giving our MPI to some of the local health departments for contact tracing purposes. Now we can kind of switch our focus to vaccines and show them people who are at the highest risk who maybe have not signed up to get the vaccine or have not yet been vaccinated, because some of them will have the bandwidth to do some outreach to those people. Next slide. And this sort of relates to I think the project that's going on in Texas with Saner that I'm really excited to hear about. So this is a graph showing the admissions and discharges in two different series during the beginning of the pandemic. And what we saw in the early days was, all of our hospitals were emptying themselves out for the COVID wave that we knew was coming. And for a period of about 6 weeks, we would see the admissions were exceeding the discharges on most days. And, that really saw the COVID bubble develop till the point where we reached our peak in the first wave. And we had several weeks of two things happening. One is the discharges are now exceeding the admissions, and gradually you see the overall level of activity start to pick back up. We are still not back to pre-COVID levels of normal activity, but I think this chart demonstrates the validity of using the kind of data that HIEs are collecting for this situational awareness assessment. Next slide. So one of the other interesting things that's come out of this work is we are engaged with several offices of emergency management. So they're usually a unit of the Department of Health or it's another county agency. But what they asked us to do was to give them a real-time dashboard showing the level of activity in area hospitals, even on an hour-by-hour basis. So a bunch of technical challenges around this, but what we've been able to do is, if you look at the next slide, what we see in this view is just the hospitals, and we're comparing their current volume with what's expected at that site, at that time of day, at that day of the week, and whether they're seeing levels that are exceeding their normal activity, and that'll make them go yellow or red. Now, this view wasn't necessarily designed for COVID, which of course builds over time. This was more a function of other types of disasters that we've seen around here, whether it's a train derailment, chemical spill, something like that would happen sort of suddenly. So this dashboard's available to the offices of emergency management for that purpose. And if you go to the next slide, there are other views in this dashboard that are looking more at trends over time that would relate more to COVID admissions. Next slide, please. So some of the challenges. So I won't go into all these just in the interest of time, but some that I'll just comment on. So having properly coded data, and I know that the use of controlled vocabularies and all the coding systems that are required by the different regulations have all been a big help, and I think have improved the overall level of data quality. But I will still say that we do still have people who are sending us, local link codes that we have to deal with, and data that is not properly coded in one way or another. With COVID in particular, it was really interesting in the early days. There are still people who are using the codes that CDC recommends not using to designate COVID-19. You sort of have to meet people where they are for this kind of work. But I really have to say the EHR developers really stepped up, because in the early days of the pandemic, people did not have the necessary codes in their coding systems, and most of the hospitals rely on the vendors to keep those libraries up to date. And they very quickly pivoted and got that information in there, and that has been a big help. But it does highlight the reliance the health systems have on the vendors for perfecting the data in that way. A general issue that we have is, of course, delays in coded diagnoses. We typically don't get these until days after an encounter. So there is sort of a lag in our ability to provide accurate data around any particular diagnosis. And I do want to, just as a policy issue, this committee might be in a position to help sort of expand public health access under HIPAA. A lot of the things that we are doing right now are possible because of the waiver of HIPAA enforcement during the COVID emergency. But once that COVID emergency period expires, we have to modify our public health use case to permit some of these things, which may require us to go back member by member to let us use their data for these public health purposes. It would be an extreme help to us just in terms of efficiency to not have to go get and document the permissions from 450 different organizations to share some level of this information with the public health agencies. So anything that ONC or this committee could do with that respect, that would be helpful. Another challenge has been around tracking nursing homes and other congregate living residents. So, you know, we have many nursing homes that are members of HSX, but when you're looking at the ADT feed or you're looking at the CCDs, it's not always straightforward to identify who is a nursing home resident sort of at the, at that moment in time. I don't think that's a field within the ADT spec, but it might be something that you could look at to include in the USCDI. Would certainly be valuable to know people who are living in these special situations that, you know, that may dictate how they're received or the care that they get. In fact, what we were left with as the best solution was to try to match on addresses. You know, the person's address comes in on an ADT message, and if you compare that with a known list of addresses from nursing homes, you can make a lot of the matches that way. But as we heard in the project earlier with the USA and addresses, that is certainly an imperfect process. So I'm anxious to hear if that project will be able to help us with that. So I think that was all we had, and welcome discussion or any questions.
All right, thank you very much for the very informative presentations and all the work that you're doing. It looks like we just have one question in the queue. Oh, here they come. First one up is Cheryl Turney.
Thank you, Denise. My question was for the HS. Oh, hold on, I have to get back to it because I wrote down my question so I wouldn't forget it. The HSX group. So you mentioned verbally, but wasn't on the slide, about pushing data to payers. The slide only showed pushing data to providers. And of course, I represent a payer, so I am interested in this because with the interoperability rules that currently are being implemented, you know, patients have the ability to come to payers to get information. And, you know, it's curious to me that we're not pushing to the payer the information that even patients would want to know, like ADTs and notifications that you had talked about from their COVID vaccines for monitoring and things of that nature. So are you automatically pushing those out to payers as well as providers?
Yeah, no, this is Phil. Thank you for the question. Yes, we are pushing. Typically, we're pushing just ADTs to health plans. We've been working hard with them to be able to send clinical data. Part of that has been, you know, they are used to getting a facsimile, and I use the word that not necessarily by fact, but, you know, an actual literal clinical record that they can go through, their auditors can go through, not a CCD, which is what we're all exchanging. So we've done quite a lot of work around HEDIS, risk adjustment, and even some prior authorization using the CCDs. I think it's still early days on that, but I think both the health plans and certainly us are incentivized to want to do that so that they would have the clinical data too.
Yeah, and I can weigh in from HXX. So we also are sharing, most of our payers are receiving encounter notifications from us. So that's, you know, that's an automated process. Not all of them, but most of them are receiving what we call real-time results. So we are sending the ADT the raw ADT messages as well as the raw CCDs to them. It just sort of depends on the payer, whether they are, you know, whether they have the infrastructure to absorb information that's formatted in that way. But and there's sort of a continuum of their, you know, their readiness to do that. But you know, we are sending all the data in real time to most of our payers.
Bill, this is Liz from HealthShare Exchange. I do just want to add one more thing, that the data that is being shared with health plans is filtered down to the eligibility roster of that health plan. So they only get data back from us on patients that are within their membership, just to clarify.
Yeah, very important point. Thank you.
Yep, that's a good clarification. Let's see, we have Clem McDonald next in the queue.
You know, first, I have, it's not crystal clear some of the mechanisms. So I'm going to make some assumption. You can correct me. Do you collect the data centrally from multiple sources? Second thing is, if you do, how do you get it? What message systems do you get it in with? Is your own hacked up ones, or are you using V2, or are you using Fire? And then I had a third one, too. Oh, and can providers at large get at the data? Look it up. Or is it just the big hospitals or even the big hospitals that can get at the data and look it up?
No, again, Phil, this, they're all great questions. We do. We get it. Typically, you know, we get V2 and V3, so HL7 V2, you know, the old-fashioned stuff over VPN tunnel. So that's encrypted. We get CCDs via web services. But we also do get some Fire, probably not so much from hospitals, you know, from electronic health records, but from other vendors a little further on with Fire. But we do get it that way. And it's a bidirectional interface. So again, kind of to my earliest comment, we try to integrate it into the workflow so that physicians, you know, anyone, as long as they have a relationship with that patient, you know, we've got the governance and the paperwork in place that they can get that data back right into their workflow, either on a query base, or we do try to set it up for automated push as well, so that, for example, you know, for transitions of care, you know, you're the PCP for the patient, they just got discharged from the hospital, we'll send you a notification and the clinical documentation so that you can follow up with them and get them within 14 days and prevent a readmission, for example.
Thank you. What about
and this
Delaware?
Is Eric, from the perspective too of the SANER project in particular, that's all based on new standards for gathering the hospital capacity information, Clem.
Okay, well, thank you. It's gratifying to hear how well some HIEs are doing.
Did any of our presenters have anything else to add from either presentation on Clem's questions?
Same story for us. So the majority of our data is coming in through CCDs and HL7 V2. I think we're on V2 2.5.1. And but we also have dedicated lab feeds coming in through ORUs. Radiology information can come in that way as well. So it's all it's all entirely standards based.
Cool. Well, you know, everybody kind of decries V2, but it's actually the engine that works right now, I think. I mean, I'm a fan of Fire, but I think most systems are depending on V2.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're using Fire primarily to let people hit our database and pull information from HSX as opposed to putting information into it, but that's certainly coming. Cool.
All right. Thank you, Clem. Les, Leonard, you're next.
Hi, thanks. This is for Larry, this question, Larry Jessup, and it's more on a policy level. I just am really excited by this program, the STAR program, being able to get HIEs. To have a core of 5 and then to move on to I guess an additional 16 or 17 HIEs in the second round is great. So I'm going to give you the softball question that every person who runs a program wants, and at the same time alienate Mickey forever by doing this. And the question I have is that is based on the premise that we're no longer in a place where we need demonstration projects that show us the way. What we need to do is lift the capability of all HIEs. So my question to you, Larry, is how much more money would you need
to be able to fund all the HIEs who applied to the STAR program to communicate between their jurisdictional IIS systems and the HIEs, and that not just the subset that you've had, all the qualified applicants for that. And then how much would you need to really raise this capability for all functional HIEs? And I think that we're around 100 HIEs in the country to be able to create this an advanced infrastructure for this, again, rather than, you know, sort of demonstration projects as to how to go. I think we need to really focus on how to lift all boats at this point, not just demonstrate a few advanced projects that all HIEs need to help.
Sure, I will give this a shot, but it's, you know, anytime you're referring to federal dollars and funding, that's never a softball question, so we'll start there. And I think that we all recognize that, you know, the federal dollars do not go nearly as far as we would like. I don't think that there's any way to determine at this point, you know, how much money we would need. Although I think with this supplemental program, we have found that, you know, with any amount of funding that we get, we are capable of designing and rolling out a program based on the needs of the country and based on the needs of, you know, what's going on with the public health agencies and based on the capabilities that exist with all the current HIEs. So, you know, no matter what that funding amount would be, you know, as that funding became available, you know, no matter the amount, I think that, you know, just given what we've been able to do with the supplement and given the areas that we've been able to identify as gaps as it relates to improving the HIE infrastructure and also improving the public health infrastructure, I think that we have a model here, but I think it's going to be, you know, yet to be determined how, you know, if we can continue to be successful with this, I would say we would just continue to supplement this program in addition to, you know, this is all unpredictable, you know, what this is, we're all new to this. And so I think that we are identifying gaps as we go along. So that would be my best answer. I think we would have to use this model again. And, you know, it's going to be very difficult to determine at this point in time, you know, what the exact amount would be needed to go forward to fund, you know, all the HIEs to do what you had mentioned before.
So as a former Fed, I'm not going to let you off. How many who ran informatics at CDC, how many applicants in the STAR program did you not fund or remain unfunded? And what's the immediate need for the ones who weren't funded?
From a grant standpoint, I don't think we're at liberty to discuss how many were not funded.
Is it as many as were funded?
Right.
I mean, a bigger than the basket, as many as were funded? Or we are, you're supervising FACA here. I realize this is a public meeting, but that would the needs be about the same as you just issued, or would it be larger? Or it seems to me that given the $1.98 trillion we're spending on the second stimulus for COVID, there might be a couple of million dollars around.
Yeah, so Les, maybe we could take this conversation. I'm not even apprised of how far deep this is. And maybe there's a lot of conversations that need to happen. So if I could ask, maybe we could table this one and then come back to it and definitely answer the question maybe with more detail, more information around it.
Sounds good to me.
And I was going to suggest that maybe it's not just the federal government that might be a funder for this. There's a lot of foundations out there that if they had insight into some of this and what it would mean for the nation, they might consider funding some of this.
Yeah, add that on the annual report work group, we do also call this item out of data exchange, and also for research purposes as well, even synthetic data sets and limited data sets. So I think there is a good opportunity to learn more here. And in this space, I think Les goes to the heart of your question, and that will answer the funding question once we know what the landscape looks like and what those priorities are. But you're right, this is a big issue. And, you know, I applaud these organizations and others, and I applaud the ONC for, you know, taking the first steps forward, helping us move this ball.
So next in the queue, we have John Kansky.
Thanks, Denise. Let me see if I can pop my camera on really fast. Oh, we're not there. Okay. Thanks. Sorry.
So first of all, I just wanted to say thanks to the presenters from Texas and Pennsylvania for sharing what I think has become one of the key learnings of the pandemic response is the value of HIEs to support public health in general. My neck is tired from nodding while you were presenting in some of the shared experiences and challenges. There's a hearing specifically on the HITAC calendar for later in the year related to HIEs and public health. And I just wanted to point that out. Les and I and Val Gray are, as HITAC members, trying to help plan the content for that hearing. So I just wanted to plug that. I also wanted to comment on the reference to policy barriers that HIEs encounter, keeping in mind there's only so much ONC can do. You know, if they have a hammer and a screwdriver, we want to try and give them tasks that utilize those tools. Utilize those tools. So I think the policy barriers that ONC can work on is important. Also, and this might be a little surprising, and I don't want to get myself in hot water with my friend Les, in terms of funding HIEs, I think there's some nuance that's needed in the policy there. I think there's a growing sentiment that HIEs need to, whatever they are now, each state needs to have a health data utility. And in some states, there are HIEs that are essentially functioning as statewide health data utilities, and in some states, there isn't. And I think just writing a check to every HIE out there isn't necessarily the best path towards that future vision. So not that money for HIEs is bad, but I think there needs to be some nuance around the funding policy to work towards this vision of HIEs as state health data utilities supporting public health. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And Nikki Tripathi's in the queue next to talk.
Great, thanks. Yeah, I didn't hear Les's question. My phone was breaking up, so I can't respond to that. I think the scalability.
Damn, you are good.
Scalability. You know, these are. I think this. You know, these initial ones that are funded are certainly basic research, and then the question of scalability. From the lessons that we learned, there are, sort of the next set of questions, obviously. But the question I have is that, actually, I have a question, and I think it's more for Eric and Phil. Eric, nice to see you again. And it's related to something that you had just touched on, and I'd love to just know a little bit more of what you're encountering on the ground. And that is, a number of the data elements that we need for the situational awareness and, supply chain kind of status don't reside in EHRs. And I think, Phil, one of your slides kind of pointed to that. There's ERP systems and PeopleSoft and RCM systems and all of that that are a part of, sort of the hospital constellation. And I'm just wondering what your experience has been in getting information out of those other systems, which are not, certified technology. So it's a little bit of the Wild West there. And a second part of the question is whether any opportunity has come up to think about the EHR perhaps as a conduit for information from those other systems that don't naturally get documented in the EHR system.
Well, very good. Thank you. And good to see you again as well, too. And congratulations and welcome to this role. We're here to support you in that. So to your first question, we actually did anticipate the scenario you described. And so the fundamental design of SANER is designed to collect data really from any applicable data source, which likely is going to be, vary depending on the hospital or the facility. And so that's accommodated for in the fundamental design. And it does that by, if you will, let's say SANER is right here. It collects data, and there's a number of adapters that plug into SANER to actually allow the data to be captured from whatever system it happens to reside at within a given organization. And to your second question, that certainly could be the EMR. That could be others as well, too, such as health information exchanges as well, too. So really, it is largely a data contract between the consumer of the hospital capacity, planning, and situational awareness data and the hospital's inner systems. in the hospital is in control of the deployment of those adapters, and so they're the authoritative source. And they also get to have provenance over, you know, the data collection from those authoritative sources so that they're very comfortable with them. And they also have, you know, the authoritative perspective on which is the best source of given information. And thank you for the great question.
No, thanks, Megan. If I could just add to that, great to meet you again. I think, you know, as I said, our first perspective is we want to make life easier for our physicians and hospitals, not add extra burden. So if they can write a report out of their ERP, you know, that dumps once a night to a comma delimited file, we'll pick that up our first goal is let's make it easy for the hospital to do this, but with the, you know, appropriate safety guides in place too, so that errors don't get transmitted.
Great, thank you.
All right, we have Clem McDonald in the queue next.
Yeah, so I wanted to comment on a couple things. So, can you hear me? Good. I'm never sure when a button's on.
Yes, okay. We can, Clem.
Okay. So one of the ways to deal with cost is, so we built, I think, the first one in Indiana, and Jen Kansky can say more about what the current state is. But it was it took about a day of software developer and stuff to hook up a VPN, which we had, I think, got up to 1,500, 1,800. I don't know where it stands now. And then to fix the message a little bit, and you had to tweak this and tweak that. But the code killed you. If we wanted to code a lab, it took 3 months, 6 months. So the coding is the barrier, I think, and the cost of the coding. And if once the ONC rules take hold, and if the codes are really in the right place, they're often hidden in many mapping tables, and I know researchers can't find them half the time, then I think the cost could be much easier. You could just flow them in. And I hope people don't dump V2 because it's mostly working in these places and you don't want to start all over. Fire, again, I'm a fan of Fire. It's great. But so those are the two thoughts. If we could get the cost down, that could help a lot. And I think part of it is the darn codes are just difficult to map from the local codes at labs or whomever sends you.
I wanted to acknowledge that very, very relevant concern. And how we've addressed this so far is actually shining light on a shared vocabulary. So the SANER project refers to these as measures. And there's an opportunity to actually curate those measures together as a country and as a world under the, in this case, the HL7 umbrella. And so there's actually an opportunity to indeed resolve that issue by collaborating together on what would be appropriate measures and vocabularies and value sets.
Yeah, and I agree, Eric, and both definitely agree that the codes are the problem. It's really hard to map all those, and I see, you know, private opportunities out there to, we don't all have to map all the codes. You know, if there's someone who hosts, for example, you know, lab codes for hospitals in Texas, that we could all bounce an API against and get them. We don't all need to maintain that. You know, one central source of truth for some of these things.
All right. I don't see any other hand up in the queue. Just hold a second to see if there's any others. And
anybody on the phone? Anybody on the phone?
Oh, yes, on the phone. Anybody on the phone? No, looks like Aaron. We'll move on then. I want to thank our presenters for your time. We really appreciate all the information you provided us and look forward to hearing more about your work.
Very good. Thank you
for
having us.
Yes, thank you
for
having us.
You're very welcome. All right, we're on to our final presentation before public comment. Public comment will be at 12:50. And so we're right on schedule. This final presentation is on the priority uses of HIT and the annual standards process and overview. And we have Chris Feer and I believe, is Wanda also on? Wanda Govan-Jenkins.
Hi, I'm just doing a sound check. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yes, we can.
Okay, great. Thank you. Hello, everyone. My name is Chris Muir, and I'm the Center's Division Director in the Office of Technology at ONC. With me is my colleague, Wanda Govan-Jenkins, who is a nurse informaticist and the person leading the Interoperability Center's Priorities Task Force efforts. We are here to discuss launching the ISP Task Force and also talk about the process for how we envision the work will go forward on an annual basis. This important work will meet the requirements of the 21st Century Cures Act, which says that the HITACH will prioritize the uses of health IT and also identify the standards and implementation specifications to support those uses. Our goal is to more closely integrate this responsibility of the HITACH with the work of ONC by convening the task force to help us further advance the interoperability standards advisory, what we affectionately call the ISA, and ensure that the HITACH's priority uses are reflected in the ISA along with the identified and related standards and implementation specifications. As you know, the ISA is a list that ONC curates and publishes on an annual basis, which contains the standards and implementation specifications available to address specific interoperability needs. Through our online ISA system, we work with our stakeholders to identify and publish an ever-growing list of standards supporting those interoperability needs. The ISA also contains helpful information about the standards that help the ISA users determine which among the competing standards may be most helpful for specific uses. The ISA is meant to be the first stop for federal and state policymakers to select among health IT standards when writing policy and regulations or developing programs. It supports such things as the ONC's health IT certification program. Additionally, health IT implementers can also go there, and it will help them determine which standards they should use for their projects. And overall, ISA is an important organizing factor for ONC standards work. So in summary, we are asking the HITACH through the ISP Task Force to help us build out the ISA to ensure that the HITACH's priority uses are reflected in the interoperability needs and that the related standards and implementation specifications are identified and published there as well. Again, we see this as an important linking of HITACH's responsibility with ONC's work. And with that, I'll turn the time over to Wanda, and she'll go through the slides, explain the charges of the task force, and also discuss how the annual process will work. And then we will take questions. Wanda?
Hi. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yep, we can hear you.
Okay, great. It's a pleasure to speak to you all again. I worked with you all closely back in 2019, the ISP Task Force. Next slide. And I'm Wanda Govan-Jenkins, and as Chris said, I'm a nurse informaticist, and I've been with ONC for about 10 years. So the charge that we are hoping that would take place, the ISP Task Force shall identify the opportunities to update the ISA, the interoperability needs sections to address the HITACH priority uses of health IT, including new priority uses for health IT if necessary. The ISP Task Force shall also recommend additional or modify interoperability needs sections for consideration and updates to the ISA, including related standards and implementation specifications. Last year, in 2019, rather, the HITACH report priority uses of health IT from the report, there were four domains. Those domains would consist of, next slide, please. Those domains consisted of cross domain, order than result, closed loop referrals and care coordination, medication and pharmacy data. Next slide. The HITACH IT Task Force we will, the ONC charges HITECH to reconvene an the ISP task force starting this month. The ISP task force shall launch and begin meetings starting this month. The ISP task force shall review ISA and starting like in March to review ISA and identify opportunities to update the ISA section to address HITECH priority uses of health IT. The ISP task force shall develop draft recommendations to add, modify the interoperability needs section for consideration and updates to the ISA, including related standards, implementation specifications. The ISP task force shall consider public feedback and developing those recommendations. During that process, March and April, HITECH shall review the ISP task force progress during that time. Lastly, in May and June, the ISP task force shall submit final recommendations to the HITECH for approval, and the HITECH shall review and approve those recommendations from the ISP task force. Next slide. This is just a chart that will just show you the ISA annual reference edition cycle that will happen after the HITECH review and approve the recommendations from after June. So starting late summer, the annual review and the comment period will open for 60 days. And then starting late fall, middle fall rather, ONC and HHS staff will review those public comments received and the HITECH recommendations, make site updates, and prepare the following year's reference edition for publication by early January. And then late winter, spring, summer of the next year, changes may be made to the web version of the ISA throughout the year, including changes considering HITECH recommendations while the ISA reference edition remains static. That concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
Let's see here. We're looking for Stephen Lane, first question.
Thank you. I really appreciate this presentation by both of you, and really applaud the fact that ONC is going to be restarting this task force. I had the pleasure of co-chairing the prior ISP task force with Dr. Kawamoto, and we really had a marvelous group, very engaged, very active, and I think produced a useful bit of feedback for the ONC. I think this is a very important process to keep moving forward on an annual basis. It certainly has been called out in our annual report, and I think is critical to the work of ONC. So I applaud the team for getting this going. I think realistically, given my role now with USCDI, I'm not going to be able to continue to co-chair the task force, but I certainly want to do everything that I can to support this work as it goes forward.
All righty. Next is Clem McDonald.
Yeah, so I'm a little confused, and maybe that's my current state, but there's ISA and there's USCDI, and they seem like there's a big overlap. So it'd be good to get some clarification about the boundaries, number one. Number two, ISA is great and grand, but the problem is it's hard to know where the line is, where this is what you got to do. Because you read about this and then there's a comment and it's hard to know what's really required. I think that's in USCDI, but it's the boundaries need to be clarified a little bit in that web page, those web pages. Because what we really have to remember that if everybody does what they want, we're going to be in the same state. The only coding system that's been super successful or the one that is Medicare, because you got to do it. You got to use the three or four code systems they say. And if there isn't some strength on this, we're going to be doing all kinds of extra work and battling for a long time. So anyway, that's the end of my soapbox.
Yeah, no, thank you, Clem, and let me take a stab at answering it. And I think the best way maybe is to think of the ISA as like pre-regulatory, or it's non-regulatory. So there is no requirement within the ISA itself that it has to be used, you know, the standards there. Now, we list a lot of standards in there that are required by regulation, but just by virtue of being listed in the ISA, you know, there's no requirements that those standards need to be used. We require standards through the regulatory process, which, you know, shows up in the certification. And also, you know, USCBI over time, you know, when it goes through the process and being adopted by regulation stuff, those will also, what's in the USCBI will be required. And so, you know, that's, I think, is really the difference. It's through those other methods that standards get adopted. The ISA really is like a big catalog of all the standards that are available. We you know, include them all. We try to provide helpful information about each of the standards and implementation specifications that has both. And then as policymakers, you know, want to, you know, add additional requirements, let's say, to the certification, or CMS wants to add some standards to their regulations, they can go to ISA, take a look at what's there, and because of all the notes and stuff you were mentioning, Clem, and, you know, the other things that we have listed there, they can, it'll help them, we hope, and we think, it helps them determine, you know, which standards they should include in their programs.
Well, thank you. I agree. It is very helpful and very informative. But you know, you go to that page to get USCDI. So I think some clarification of what world you're in when you're going there might be helpful.
Okay. No, that's really good feedback. And I understand where you're coming from there. We are using the same platform for both, and that may be a little confusing.
All right, so good conversation here. Any other questions from folks on the line or on the phone as well? I see Jonathan.
Hey, yeah, thanks. So I think this is, I appreciate Clem's comment, and the I was going to make a comment on the USCBI presentation earlier. I think this is an area where there's some regulatory perversity. I won't go into how all this works now that make it difficult for us to advance standards and stick to standards and focus work in the healthcare system and the vendors on moving the interoperability agenda forward. And this overlap is maybe, you know, indicative, but a minor issue. And I think there's an opportunity now to take us. I mean, the last administration, I think, really did a lot of good in this space, but it started to, some of these conflicts came out. Like, for example, UCDSI requires free sharing of information, so it disincentivizes some of the participants for adequate, you know, for really robustly advancing standards because they kind of, by doing so, they cost themselves more money and maybe forego other financial opportunities. This is just one of the issues that we have. So I'm hoping, you know, Mickey, that we can take a step back and think about what's the best way now, given where we are, given all the advancements we've had, how to move this forward.
All right. Ken. I see you have your hand raised.
Thanks. So yeah, maybe just echoing a little bit what Jonathan's saying as well. I feel like right now a lot of the focus is rightfully on USCDI. There's a clear, you know, if you implement this, if we specify it here, you must implement kind of notion. At the same time, there's a lot of issues around it, like the fact that there aren't really currently any federal initiatives to try to promote and mature things that are lower down the list. And, you know, I think that's one place to look. Maybe the scenario the ISP task force can really focus on to try to use their efforts to look at things that are further down the list and, you know, work out what the right standards are and things like that as well. And I think in general, just seeing if there's ways we can improve the incentive structure, I think would be good. like I think maybe Jonathan was alluding to, there is really perverse incentive now where we have enshrined in regulation that if you make it to USCDI as a EHR vendor, you may not make money off of it. And some major vendors have taken that and said, okay, if it's there, we're just going to make it available for free, right? And there's obvious issues there when you're saying the moment something enters it, if you were making any money off of it, you may no longer make any money off of it. So I think it's, you know, it is what it is now, but we should really be looking at it, maybe taking a step back, you know, what do we fundamentally need to do to make standards that make sense to implement and are implemented widely? Because I do feel like the current approach will basically result in the current status quo staying relatively unmoved for 5-10 years.
Thanks. And Ken, this is Aaron. Just to my understanding, when you're saying make money off of a standard, are you referring to like a specific registry, like a clinical registry of some sort, or a specific data class?
Yeah. In the regulations, it says if for the U.S. core data interoperability, you may not make a profit off of it, right? It says you can only do cost recovery, which is also tricky and also gets to the point where it's leading some major vendors to say, okay, well, it's not worth it for us to like figure out exactly how much we can charge without running afoul of regulations. We're just going to make that available for free, right? Because then you have every incentive to leave as much as possible in the not USCDI bucket, because then you can actually charge for it.
I see your point. I got you. Okay. Thank you. Thank you for the clarification. Any other questions from the committee or folks on the phone? I do think this is a critical, critical topic, and I'm glad to see, I echo what Dr. Lane was saying, I'm glad this is being restarted. This is a great committee. Okay. Well, I don't see or hear any. So Denise, what do you think about, we ask for any general questions from the committee? Because I know we are about 15 minutes from time of, I mean, we can always do public comment early, but the closer we are, the easier it is for the public.
Hey, Aaron, yes, that's what I was going to suggest since, oh, sorry. I was
sorry, go ahead, Lauren.
Since we do have time.
If there's any
discussion or questions on any of the topics we had today from the committee, we could open the floor for that, or Lauren, if you prefer to go to public comment early, we can certainly do that too.
Sure, we can do that. We'll ask the contractor to pull up the public comment phone number. In the meantime, for those that served on the prior ISP task force, we'll just assume that you are indeed interested in remaining. If you're not, I know that we just started the USCDI task force, so we want to be respectful of your time and bandwidth. So if you want to just shoot me a note to let me know of your preference. Also, if you are interested in serving as co-chair for the ISP, please let me know as well. I want to thank Stephen Lane for previous co-chairing, but we are taxing him with the USCDI task force for now. And we will certainly be back in touch in terms of the kickoff date for that task force.
And it looks like Steve Posnack has his hand up if we want to hear from Steve before we go to public comment.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate it. Just to follow up quickly on Ken's comment, I guess in reaction to Jonathan as well, and I'm sure this is probably an offline conversation. We went to great lengths to make sure that there was an opportunity for cost recovery, both in terms of the certification program parameters for the conditions of certification, so that the research and development engine for our regulated entities, in this case health IT developers, were able to recoup costs that would allow them to continue to make changes and update their technology over time. And so while there are particular policies that focus on usage costs that have certain limits from a financial perspective for certified APIs, the information blocking side as well included the opportunity for, I believe we put reasonable profit or something along those lines in the terminology. Let me go back over to the website was loading slow for me in terms of the fees area. But I did just want to note that there, to kind of set the record straight, that the cost prohibitions are not as they were represented. I'm happy to talk about that further.
Thank you for making that clarification. Lauren, I think we can go to public comment. I don't see any other hands up at this moment. I think you're on mute.
Thank you. At this time, we'll ask the operator to open the public line.
Thank you. If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your line from the queue. And for participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. Our first question or comment is from Shelley Spiro with Pharmacy HIT Collaborative. Please proceed.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Shelley Spiro. I'm the Executive Director of the Pharmacy HIT Collaborative, representing over 250,000 members of the majority national pharmacy associations, including pharmacy education and accreditation, and 13 associate members. A major focus of the Pharmacy HIT Collaborative is to assure pharmacists in all practice settings, community, health system, hospital, managed care, behavioral health, and long-term post-acute care are integrated into the national health IT infrastructure. With the wide adoption of the Pharmacist Electronic Care Plan effort using the FHIR standards, Pharmacy HIT Collaborative commented on the US CDI version 2 with additional data elements needed to be included in US CDI version 2 to assure non-traditional EHR vendors are able to certify for interoperable exchange of clinical information. This includes pharmacy system vendors that are sharing over 1 million pharmacist-provided electronic care plans. Pharmacy HIT Collaborative is a steward of over 650 SNOMED CT codes and over 100 value sets within the National Library of Medicine's Value Set Authority Center to standardize the collection, documentation, and sharing of medication-related pharmacist-provided clinical services with standards such as the Pharmacist Electronic Care Plan. The Pharmacy HIT Collaborative made comments, including 2 new data points under the new class for a payer coverage data points to be included and are being used within the Pharmacist Electronic Care Plan. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you for those comments.
Okay, we're seeing no further comments from the public. So we do have about 9 minutes. Well, no, actually, we've got about 15 minutes, to be honest with you, but we can always give time back to folks. Are there any questions? I think let's take up what Denise was saying. Are there any questions from the HITACH on any of the topics today or needing further elaboration just because we were running out of time in a certain section? I do want to give the committee plenty of ample opportunity here with this group. Let's see. I see Stephen Lane.
Stephen has the same.
Yeah, I actually just wanted to follow up on the comment from the Pharmacy HIT Collaborative that we just heard regarding the comments submitted regarding US CDI version 2. And it strikes me, I haven't seen those comments yet. I haven't tripped on them. We've discussed with the ONC team that navigating the site can be a little challenging. I'll keep looking for them. But if someone wants to send me a link to show me where those comments got posted, that would be really helpful. But also it'd be nice on that site if we could create some sort of a search function to allow one to find comments either by keyword or a topic area, et cetera. Because I think as we get more and more comments on the site, it's going to be increasingly challenging for people to find them all and sort through them.
That's a good point, Stephen. It's a great point. And I've seen a lot of comments here about information just being readily disseminated out there of all the good work that's going on. So to your point about maybe trying to help coalesce questions or inquiries or comments, that's always helpful, right? So it makes a lot of sense.
Okay. Other questions or topics from folks? All right. Well, this is a great, great discussion, Denise. I mean, I think we could move to closing remarks here and close out the day. Lauren, is there any objection?
No objection. Just a quick reminder, our next meeting is actually a month from today on March 10th. All the materials from today's meeting can be found on our HITECH calendar on healthit.gov. Again, shoot me a note. Let me know your preference on ISP Task Force. And if you have any follow-up questions regarding USCDI, feel free to contact Stephen or Terry or Al from ONC. Otherwise, that's all I have for today.
Wonderful, wonderful. And so for closing comments from Denise and I, go ahead, Denise.
Yes, I just wanted to mention, and you and I, Aaron, are both on the USCDI task force, just to let the entire committee know that we are meeting on Tuesday, and I believe it's from 10:30 to noon on Eastern time, in case you want to listen in or join any of those meetings. And I want to thank everybody today for the very thoughtful comments and questions and for engaging in the topics today. I thought we had a really excellent dialogue, particularly around the USCDI and around public health information exchange.
Absolutely.
So thank
you. Absolutely agree. And also just let me echo this for all the folks on the front lines and the provider organizations and those that are in the middle of treating COVID-19 patients, as well as the vaccination efforts that are going on. Hats off to you. It's not easy, and taking time out of your morning to do this, it's critical because this is helping advancement from a national perspective. So I wish best of health to all of you. You have a good, enjoy the Valentine's weekend. It'll be freezing here in Austin, Texas, but that's okay. Hopefully it's warmer where you are. We'll definitely see you at the next meeting. Mickey, did you want to make any closing comments?
Nope.
Okay.
Just wanted to thank everyone and thank both of you for leading a great discussion.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your attendance. Everybody have a great day. Be safe.
Bye, everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.